with a loving look in her eyes. And she never did me wrong, and that's no lie. When I said I was leaving, she tried hard not to cry, cry, cry. But I packed up my clothes and my old guitar. I threw all my junk in the back of my car. I blew her a kiss and I waved bye-bye. It's back, back, back to Oklahoma once again. I don't want you to think that you won't always be a friend. But there's roots inside me you don't understand. I gotta go back home again. In New York City there's a bright day burning flame. In the heart of a woman and I know she calls my name. Though I tried to please her, my memory stays the same, same, same. So I packed up my clothes and my old guitar. Threw all my junk in the back of my car. I blew her a keys, couldn't play the game. It's back, back, back to Oklahoma once again. I don't want you to think that you won't always be a friend. But there's roots inside me you don't understand. I gotta go back home again. There won't be no big welcoming committee. Just a lonely girl and a tiny little son who never had a chance to know his daddy. Cause all his daddy knew to do was run. Now my windshield wiper keeps the beat to my song. And the one that leaks in on me as I drive along. And it's good to be doing right instead of wrong, wrong, wrong. Well, I got all my clothes and my old guitar. I'm heading on home with my junk in my car. It's gonna be good where I belong. It's back. I don't want you to think that you won't always be a friend. But there's roots inside me you don't understand. I gotta go back home again. I gotta go back home again.
Yes, I am. Here's my train coming now. I'm homeward bound. Yes, I'm going back today. And brother, I expect to stay. Going home to Oklahoma. Yes, I am. All aboard for Oklahoma. Let this Okie get on board. I'm going home. When it rains, we call it rain. We don't bother to explain. Let this Okie get on board. I'm going home. Home, where the snow white cotton blooms. I'm all through with picking prunes. Let this Okie get on board. I'm going home.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good night. Good, I don't know, August, right? Is it fall yet? Is summer over yet? I'm ready for summer to be over. Oh, it's not over yet. Not yet. We got a little bit ways to go. All right, well, welcome to part three of the Insomnia Stream PetCon edition. I am your host, Devin Steck, and we are going to be talking about... Well, we're gonna continue talking about, I guess, healing hate, indivisible. The propaganda piece that is trying really hard to make everyone in the right wing look like a terrorist, and so the Justice Department can feel justified in stomping on their everything they can, every piece of them, physically, mentally, spiritually, everything. And speaking of which, one of the January 6th guys that was sentenced, what was it, yesterday? I forgot about this. I probably should have pulled a clip. But one of the guys from January 6th, you guys will probably remember this. Remember the guy who was ratted out by his anime-loving son? And CNN interviewed his like super soy son that was like, yeah, I totally ratted my dad out because he was dangerous. I had to call the FBI, told him that I saw him in the footage in the Capitol, and CNN was making this sound like, oh, this is so great, these kids ratting their parents out to the authorities. That guy got sentenced. And that same son, that same Anagay watching son, wrote a letter to the judge asking for the maximum sentence for his father. Which was 7 years. Unfortunately, he got it. So, again, I wish I pulled the clip because it's pretty disgusting watching this faggot talk. Yeah, and you can tell that he's just loving being on CNN. You can tell he literally put his dad in jail for 7 years for the Reddit gold. For real. You can tell that's the kind of a faggot this guy is. So, homeschool your kids. Look, obviously that's a huge fail on the dad. I mean, if you raise a kid like that, I mean, you almost deserve to be in jail for 7 years, but fuck. This is what happens when you're not paying attention to who's raising your children, because the system will take care of that for you. Anyway, let's move on to part three here. Let me make sure I got this all set up correctly. I think I do. All right, so let's get in the mood for healing hate.
It is a story decades in the making.
They call themselves
the Aryan Nation.
Desperate. Angry. Destructive. The nation stopped in its tracks.
Angry mob of supporters.
The most sacred symbol of America's democracy attacked. A nation already deeply divided over politics, race, and economic inequality. And now the claim of a stolen election. Extremists inciting rage. Some using violence. How did we get here? What fuels their fury? How grave is the threat to democracy? How do we heal the hate?
How do we heal the hate, indeed? So, last week, if you remember, we, in part two, the wonderful producers, the mixture of SPLC and Deep State, is there really a difference? The line's pretty blurry. Producers of this wonderful piece of propaganda, they said that healing the hate was necessary to understand where the hate came from. So part one, of course, they talked about some of the militia movement that was starting to pop up in the 80s and 90s, and the great work of the SPLC and the federal government to stomp and often murder the people involved with that. And then last week, last stream, it was about Waco. And at the end of the Waco incident, you heard the people say, and then Timothy McVeigh, who was at Waco selling bumper stickers, that's when he went crazy. That's when he went crazy and started his plan to do the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, because there's so much stuff they get into and they lie so much, I'm not going to do kind of like the tit for tat kind of stuff that I was doing with Waco, because Waco, they just left out so many details. It was, you know, it was easier. With this, they leave out a lot of details too, but I think it's easier maybe to let them kind of give their version this time. Yeah, I gotta change something here. I don't know. I guess it's working. That's weird. I don't know. It's okay. Well, I don't know why that's, never mind. Ignore everything I just mumbled about. So we're gonna play kind of their version of events, and actually, you know, first I'll play the intro and I'll explain why it's relevant, because a lot of people might be wondering too, like, well, this is Oklahoma City bombing. This happened, like, you know, when I was a little kid or before I was alive back in the 90s. You know, depending on how old you are, but it's very relevant, and I'll explain why.
An angry ex-soldier named Timothy McVeigh.
He was there on the day of the fire, selling bumper stickers that said, if guns are outlawed, then I'll become an outlaw.
First of all, it's interesting that they chose that as like the evil bumper sticker. If guns become illegal, I'll become, or against the law, I'll become an outlaw, or whatever however she put it. That's the right attitude to have. That's the American attitude. Because that would be unconstitutional. That would 100%, that's literally the line that even boomers won't let the federal government cross. Like, even boomers will wheel themselves out into the streets and shake their AR-15s over their heads and say, I'd like to see you pry it from my cold, dead hands. Like, that's... So it's just weird that that's the extremist bumper sticker that she picked.
Timothy McVeigh came away from Waco a loaded pistol.
Whoa, a loaded pistol. At least it wasn't like a loaded AR assault rifle, 15. All right, so anyway, you might ask, like, all right, well, this is Oklahoma City. Like, how are they tying this in? You got to understand, as I've been saying over and over with all these streams, and it'll be true again with this one, it's all the same people. The same fucking people. Not the same kinds of people, but the same people that were in charge of these operations back in the 90s are the people running your country now. They're the people running the federal agencies right now. They're the people that are still at war with white people, just like they were in the 90s. They have been systematically trying to crush any group of white people who believe in having a means of self-defense and a healthy respect for how the country was founded, with an emphasis on Christians. That's just the way that it is. And if you don't believe me, look, this is a clip from Merrick Garland's, this is his hearing before they confirmed him when he was just picked out by Biden. And by the way, Republicans all voted for this guy, right? Well, I don't know. I don't think every Republican necessarily, but enough to get him in there. So here's what they could have blocked him.
We abhor violence, whether it comes from the right or left, whatever its source. It has no place in responsible constitutional dialogue in America. Currently, though, we are faced with elements that weren't there 25 years ago in Oklahoma City. A proliferation of weapons. Secondly, social media and the internet, which serves as a gathering place for many of these domestic terrorists. What are your thoughts about how we should deal with those?
So that's Dick Durbin. Again, they're still talking about it, saying, yeah, you know, it's worse now than when the Oklahoma City bombing happened. You know, these terrorists didn't have social media where they could congregate. Now they do. Who do you think they're talking about? Who do you think Dick Durbin's talking about when he makes a statement like that? So he's saying that, oh yeah, because it's so much more dangerous now than the Oklahoma City bombing. Like, what are you going to do? Are you going to take that? Are you going to think about that when you rule, or rather direct the energy of the FBI and the DOJ toward, and the ATF and every other agency towards our political opponents?
Those elements from the law enforcement viewpoint.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I certainly agree that we are facing a more dangerous period than we faced in Oklahoma City at that time. From what I have seen, and I have no inside information.
See, Merrick Garland, he agrees. Oh, I certainly agree that now is a more dangerous time than the time of the Oklahoma City bombing.
Information about how the department is developing its work. It looks like an extremely aggressive and perfectly appropriate beginning to an investigation all across the country in the same way our original Oklahoma City investigation was, but many times more. I don't yet know what additional resources would be required by the department. I can assure you that this will be my first priority.
His first priority is going to be using the same resources that they used in respect to the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, I want you to understand, Dick Durbin understands what that really means. People watching on C-SPAN might not. Because the people watching on C-SPAN just think, oh, okay, well, they're going to have a lot of people that can figure out where the crazy domestic terrorists are and track them down and arrest them like they did Timothy McVeigh. Really? Was that the federal government's involvement? Was that the FBI's involvement with that? Were those the resources they used? I think we'll find out tonight. So let's go. Let's move on to the propaganda piece put out by these very people. Healing Hate. Let's hear their side of the story.
Get them back!
Goddamn.
All of a sudden, explosion, roof caved in. Just sitting here?
Yeah, just sitting right here.
We gotta find this brother.
Wow. Holy cow. About a third of the building has been blown away.
The bombing in Oklahoma City was an attack on innocent children and defenseless citizens. We will find the people who did this.
The crowd here going crazy, booing as they see the first glimpse of this man.
He was a soldier without a war.
His goal was to end the United States government as we know it, just as we saw the attempt to do so on January 6th.
All right, see, you see what they're doing? Oh yeah, he was trying to end the government as we know it, just like January 6th, guys.
As we know it. Just as we saw the attempt to do so on January 6th.
Yeah, just like January 6th, you know, just he was trying to do January 6th, January's insurrection. So they go on to talk about, you know, how horrible the Oklahoma City bombing was. They do like this You know, look at this old man. He lost his daughter. It's so terrible. The fucked up, disgusting thing about this whole thing is it's like that he doesn't know. Like this old man right here literally thinks it was like some evil white supremacist that killed his daughter. It's so disgusting. Anyway, so they go through the monument, like, oh, there was some, you know, the 17 kids that died, and you know, whatever. And look, they did 17 kids. That's they just don't care. They really don't care. They would have killed 72 kids. They don't care. They went at Waco, they killed more than 17.
It was an unexceptional federal building in Oklahoma City, but its bombing was the most devastating terrorist attack on U.S. soil in history.
A day that this might have somehow coincided with the second anniversary of the cult compound fire in Waco involving the Branch Davidians.
It would be an uncanny coincidence if the federal building were randomly bombed on the exact same day that 2 years earlier, 76 men, women, and children died at Waco in a fire that the far right blamed on the U.S. government.
I like how the far right blamed on the U.S. government with zero details, as we saw last stream. They literally gave you, if you didn't know anything about Waco and you watched the video, you know, the last part of this episode where they're talking about Waco, you would think that it was just all just fever dreams, all just the crazy imaginations of delusional right wingers.
Anti-federal government groups that we see now, like the Boogaloo Boys.
Yes, actually, just like the Boogaloo Boys. Speaking of PetCon, the fact that they bring in the Boogaloo Boys, unironically. Anyway, let's hear it again.
Anti-federal government groups that we see now, like the Boogaloo Boys, like the Oath Keepers. This is a very important day.
Yeah, everyone knows that it's a very important day. Don't we all just get together and celebrate April 19th? I know there's people that celebrate April 20th, but April 19th, really? Really? I've never heard of that. I guess that's what the Boogaloo Boys do. They celebrate April 19th.
Ground Zero ATF agents have been working in the plywood-covered bomb crater. They now estimate the bomb weighed 5,000 pounds. It was hauled in a truck like this, 24 feet.
As soon as we realized the truck had been rented at a particular location in Kansas, investigators were sent there, agents were sent.
Oh, it's this asshole. It's this guy that lied about Waco saying, oh yeah, and then we filled up the complex with pepper gas. Let's see what he has to say about this.
Sent there, and they were able to get a sketch from the individual who rented the truck. Information from the rental receipt itself was the name on the receipt was Robert Kling.
All right, I'm sorry. Look, I'm going to have to interject like a little bit. He's already lying like so much that I have to at least interject. He's lying from like the official fucking story line. Like, he just said that, all right.
We're able to get a sketch from the individual who rented the truck.
There was just one guy. Just one guy that rented the truck. There was definitely just one guy that rented the Ryder truck, right? Just one guy that the employees at Elliot's Body Shop saw, right? It was just one guy that people saw in the truck, right?
Two white males were associated with this vehicle. As a result, arrest warrants will be sought for these two males.
Well, wait a second. Why is the FBI director saying that there's two white males that they're looking for that rented the truck back when it happened? Well, that's weird.
The first man is of medium build with a light brown crew cut, and he is right-handed.
McVeigh.
The second man is also medium build, He's further described as 5 feet 9 inches to 5 feet 10 inches tall, with brown hair and a tattoo visible on his left arm.
That's weird. Why? So why didn't this guy, you know, Captain Pepper Gas over here? Why? I don't understand. Like, how did he miss, like, a huge detail like that? That seems like a big thing to miss, right? You know, there was a manhunt for two guys they had sketches for that the employees at the store reported seeing, that 20-something other eyewitnesses reported seeing, to an individual. That's weird. Huh. Maybe he just has a bad memory. Oh, wait, what's this?
John Doe number 2 remains at large. He should be considered armed and extremely dangerous.
Well, what? That's weird. Even Janet Reno is saying that there's another guy. Huh. I'm sure it's nothing. I'm sure it's absolutely nothing. We'll get to that in a minute, guys. Sorry, I just... That lying sack of shit. Like, everything he says is just like, it's so fucking, like, it's so lying. That it's just, it's, oh, God. Anyway, sorry.
The authorities released a sketch of him and were quickly inundated with literally thousands of calls and leads.
It seemed impossible that we would find this guy. And then a state trooper saw the sketch and said, "Yeah, that kind of looks like the guy that I arrested a couple of days ago. Better make a phone call."
Yeah, that's what happened. We'll get to it. So, oh, you fucking God! such a scumbag. Where do they find these fucks? Anyway,
more than 5 hours today, and here he is, right there, the man with the crew cut, Timothy McVeigh, 27 years old.
Tonight, McVeigh is behind the walls of the El Reno Federal Prison, isolated from the inmates. He is not cooperating with investigators.
Investigators discover that McVeigh was a decorated Army sergeant who served in the Persian Gulf War. How did he come to feel betrayed by a government he had once sworn to defend? And what can McVeigh's story teach us about the anger of some of the veterans who joined the mob on January 6th?
I don't know. I guess that all depends on if the veterans you're talking about are current employees of the federal government. Because many of them were. But go on.
The personal grievance for McVeigh is that he served honorably as a soldier in Desert Storm, in Kuwait, and in Iraq. He was called back to go through the Special Forces assessment selection process. But the irony was that McVeigh was out of shape because he'd been in a Bradley fighting vehicle for months and hadn't been able to exercise. So he failed the endurance run to be a Green Beret, which for him was being the ultimate warrior. McVeigh was so humiliated and so angered by that rejection that he never returned. He finished out his enlistment and he left the U.S. Army.
I'm sorry. Oh my God. Wow.
Wow.
So yeah, the official story is that he was I mean, I just can't believe that they're saying that with a straight face. Oh yeah, he was like this really, you know, really gung-ho soldier that was, you know, he was gonna try out for special forces, and then he went into war and was in fact was in charge of protecting General Schwarzkopf and like was decorated and then when he came back he was so out of shape from being at war that he failed the ruck march. Like, they're literally saying he couldn't do the ruck march for special forces. And then he got so mad he blew up a building. That's the story. That's okay. Just I'm sorry. I'm not trying to insult your intelligence. It's just that this is what people think. It's about to get a lot more annoying, by the way. Like, as they start to try to, because they know it's a stupid story. They know it's the stupidest story you've ever heard. Even like a stupid person's like, really? That's what happened? So this is where they have to swoop in and throw all this like pop sci gobbledygook at you. So like it makes sense. So you have to be like, oh, now I get it. It's because of like,
he felt that the military didn't give him an opportunity to manifest his patriotism and love for his country. And that eventually transformed into a very strong hostility and animosity towards the government.
Okay. So, like, they wouldn't let him be patriotic. He wanted so bad to be patriotic, they wouldn't let him be patriotic. So then he decided to fucking blow up a building and do the exact opposite of what he was trying to do.
He wanted mainly to gain attention to what he perceived as America losing its identity because its government is so corrupt. Eventually, he decided to do something about it.
We see this with a lot of the lone actor terrorists. They will actually carry with them certain amulets that signifies their connection to their cause. And McVeigh wore a T-shirt.
Totally. Yeah, all terrorists, they carry these amulets around with them. Now, we see this all the time with these lone actors. Oh my god, it's like a total textbook lone wolf. They always have these amulets, like this T-shirt, for example, that you could buy at any truck stop that says the Tree of Liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. You know, God forbid that we have a quote from a former a president on a T-shirt. You know, it's obvious. That's just domestic terrorists. They have these amulets.
With a quote from Thomas Jefferson on it, the Tree of Liberty must from time to time be replenished with the blood of patriots and tyrants. For McVeigh, this was part of his identification as a new founding father, the first hero of the Second American Revolution. In the car itself was a book called The Turner Diaries.
So then they go into the Turner Diaries for a little bit, which is fun. And they try to tie that. The funny thing is, they try to tie the turn. They want so bad. I don't know why. They really want to tie the Turner Diaries to January 6th and this hokey little gallows, like this. Like these couple of 2x4s someone nailed together and threw a rope on. Like they really want you to think that the people at like the Q-tards on January 6th were really going to try to hang Mike Pence.
What I think is an iconic photograph of the Capitol and the representation of a noose is a direct thread back to the Turner Diaries, a book which I have here. The hangings have helped everyone get off the fence in a hurry. I'm sure that without the forceful lesson of this day of the rope, we would not have so quickly elicited this sort of citizen cooperation. The hangings have helped. And this notion of the first people to be executed are going to be the traitors. And then, of course, we saw that.
So, yeah, we had a little hiccup on the internet. And then I forgot to unmute myself when I reset that. So if you listen to the recording, it just got quiet for like a minute. So I apologize for that. Anyway. So... fucking internet. It's every stream. It just hiccups that one. Well, hopefully knock on wood that one time. It always hiccups like in the first like hour or so. I don't know why. And it's always on. Well, it's always something on like on a danger word like Day of the Rope. Anyway, so they talk about Day of the Rope for a while. They start interviewing the son of the author of Day of the Rope, William Pierce, Kelvin Pierce, who is a whiny little liberal now, and he cries about his dad, says dad was mean, and that he was scared when he saw January 6th because it was all the hate that his dad had somehow put into the world and all this garbage. So they go on this crazy detour about the Turner Diaries that has anyway, and then they finally get back to, which, by the way, well, we'll get into it, we'll get into it later.
The FBI uncovered links between McVeigh and far-right anti-government militias.
Someone had said that Timothy McVeigh was a member of the Michigan militia, and he had attended a meeting.
So this is kind of funny. Again, they put this in here unironically. So this guy here is a member of the Michigan militia, or at least, I don't know, maybe former, but at the time was. And he's describing exactly the kind of behavior that militias all over the United States describe when talking about Timothy McVeigh. That all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this guy shows up and he's like, hey guys, want to go blow up some buildings, huh? That sound like fun, huh? Yeah?
Someone had said that Timothy McVeigh was a member of the Michigan militia, and he had attended a meeting and he was asked to leave. I don't know the specifics of what he said, but when you are thrown out of a Michigan militia meeting, you have spouted something off pretty bad. And that was the entire connection. After the Murrah bombing in Oklahoma City, we lost easily 80% of our members, probably more. A lot of people said, I know we didn't do it, but I'm losing business, or my boss is going to fire me. I have to quit. Okay, bye. The people that remained were the ones who were not going to wilt when the sun got hot, if you know what I'm saying.
So it destroyed a lot of the militia movement. Mission accomplished, you might say. You had a Timothy McVeigh show up to all these different meetings. Look, he showed up at Bill Cooper's house around this same time. I was like, hey, you want to talk to me, my friend, about maybe blowing up some buildings? And Bill Cooper told him to fuck off. The Michigan militia kicked him out. And like the guy said, like, if we're kicking you out, you're like fucking glowing hard. You know, because we say some crazy stuff. And if you're getting kicked out by us, you're saying like really crazy shit. So then they try to connect it to, they literally use this. They use people waving Keck flags. Like, there's your domestic terrorists right there. You guys see the domestic terrorists? Inspired by Timothy McVeigh. January 6th, it was, oh my God, it was so violent and scary.
I was there for portions of the trial, and...
Why am I not surprised? Seems like everyone they're talking to played some kind of role in all of these operations. But do go on.
Was able to not only study McVeigh indirectly, but also observe him at trial. Invariably, with the lone actor terrorist, there's moral outrage toward a suffering group, where you actually vicariously identify with the group that is suffering. His moral outrage was his identification with the suffering at Ruby Ridge amongst the Weaver family and the suffering of the men, women, and children that had died at Waco.
And it's the fault of the media as well as our government leaders for failing to label these ideologically motivated acts as terrorism. A body count has nothing to do with whether a violent act is terrorism or not.
By the way, he's talking about right-wing protesters. This faggot's like, oh yeah, it doesn't matter if they're actually killing people or not. It's still terrorism. again, without a hint of irony, without even for a second thinking about, like, wow, if January 6th was terrorism, then we got to arrest, like, oh, I don't know, 13% of the country.
Of the media, as well as our government leaders, for failing to label these ideologically motivated acts as terrorism.
It's the media's fault. It's the media. The media is just, they're just too soft on right-wingers.
Body count has nothing to do with whether a violent act is terrorism or not. It's whether it's ideologically motivated violence meant to instill fear in a community or influence government policy. You don't have to kill anybody in order to commit a terrorist act.
Where are they meeting at?
Hey, where are they killing the fucking folks?
More than 2 years after the deadly attack, McVeigh was found guilty and sentenced to death.
Stop the steal! Stop the steal!
Today, it's tribal, it's pathological. Elections are there to determine winners, and you have to accept the results.
January 6th was, you know, a perfect example of, you know, the election was stolen and we have to do something about it.
So there you go. It was totally a insurrection inspired by domestic terrorists like Timothy McVeigh. Now, I want you to listen to a clip here before we dive into what really happened in Oklahoma City and who exactly Timothy McVeigh really was and who he worked for. This is called PatCon Edition for a reason. And this guy is going to discuss briefly what that reason is.
The FBI began to distance itself from PatCon when I was probing, and they said it was just a simple operation where they were going to infiltrate some militia folks in Alabama who had stolen some night vision goggles from a military base and were selling them. But it was clear to me that PatCon was bigger than that, much, much bigger. And there were PatCon operations going on all over the country. And they referred to them as PatCon Group 1, PatCon Group 2, PatCon Group 3.
PatCon, meaning that's the FBI's name for their wide-scale, you say, investigation and infiltration of the radical right in the early, mid-1990s.
Apparently it went throughout the 90s because here last summer I received a phone call from a fellow who said, I've been seeing what's been posted on the Internet from your FOIA lawsuits with the FBI. And he said, you have all the pieces, but you just haven't put them together. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you just don't see the picture. And so he came to see me, and I directed him to Newsweek magazine and to some other reporters. He had been one of the top undercover operatives for the FBI and PatCon for almost 10 years. He had infiltrated some 23 groups. He started out believing it was the right thing. He wasn't, you know, so many of these informants are people who are caught in the act of committing a crime and are forced to go undercover for the FBI. He did it voluntarily because he thought these hate groups, what described him as hate groups, were dangerous. In hindsight, he said he looked back on it and he sees now that the agenda was to infiltrate and incite the militia movement, the right-wing Christian movement, the violence, so that the Department of Justice could crush him. He said that Ruby Ridge was a PatCon operation. He said that Waco was a PatCon operation. He believed that Oklahoma City was, but he wasn't involved in it. But he did say that other members of the PatCon group were involved in Oklahoma City.
So PatCon was a code word for a program that the FBI had throughout the 90s, and I'm sure the same kind of program either exists today or perhaps under a different name, but I really doubt that kind of behavior has stopped. But throughout the 90s, probably in the 80s as well, They had several groups that would infiltrate militia movements, Christian movements. Remember, they even today, the FBI classifies pro-life groups as potential domestic terrorists. You're an extremist. Which, I mean, it makes sense. Like, if you have an FBI that's run by the kinds of people that we know run the FBI, and you're anti-abortion, that's an extremist position. They don't even know anyone that's pro-life. If you work at the FBI, you probably don't know anyone. Like, at least at the offices in Virginia. If you work in D.C. or Virginia, you probably don't know anyone that's pro-life. So, of course, it sounds like an extremist position. And so all throughout the 80s and 90s, they're infiltrating these right-wing groups that may or may not even have a militia element to them. Many of them, as he said, were coerced into doing it like they were trying to do with Randy Weaver at Ruby Ridge, where they convinced him to saw off a shotgun and then said that they were going to charge him with the federal violation of manufacturing a sawed-off shotgun. They were going to throw the book at him unless he turned into a snitch for him. And that's how they got a lot of these guys. They would coerce them, or they would I'm sure pay them off, or they would look for these people that would want to save their own skin. And so they would turn into spies, essentially. But in the case of this guy, this other guy that he was dealing with, this guy was, he volunteered. He wanted to do it. He thought these quote-unquote hate groups were dangerous, he said. But then he realized that the actual motive was to try to stir up violence in these groups, much in the same way that we just saw with the supposed plot against the Michigan governor, the supposed plot the FBI foiled, when almost everyone involved was literally an FBI agent or informant, aside from like some homeless guy who was acquitted. So they're still doing it. Whether or not they call it PatCon anymore, who knows. But they've been doing it a long time, and they were particularly nervous back in the 90s because in the 90s, the culture was much different. In the 80s and 90s, the culture was way different. You had, and you got to think about too, you had a lot of people who had served in Vietnam. And so they had combat experience. A lot of these guys, that were in these militias, not only had combat experience, but pretty fucked up combat experience. You also had a time that was in the time in America's history where you could buy a lot of explosives. You could buy fully automatic weapons. The Brady Bill didn't happen until the 90s. And the bill that the Oklahoma City bombing got passed didn't happen until the late 90s that restricted the availability of explosives. So they needed to tamp down any possible resistance that they might have down the road, because again, it's the same fucking people. The same people today that are pushing tranny shit and all this other stuff were the people that were in charge of the legislation that neutered, well, the legislation and the programs like PatCon that neutered the right wing. So this here is Timothy McVeigh's lawyer I have a bunch of clips. Unfortunately, because there's so many, not all of them are smoothly or perfectly placed, but they're all grouped together.
We're talking about people that are interviewed on Wednesday.
Okay, so sorry. I had to play the first part to remember, remind myself what it was. So we talked briefly about how there were two people seen. So let's start from the beginning. The beginning was Timothy McVeigh, all by himself, went and rented a Ryder truck and then filled it full of, like, they didn't talk about this in the propaganda piece, but the official story is he and a friend of his filled it full of explosives made with ammonium nitrate, or I think that's what it was, and in 50-gallon drums in the back of the Ryder truck, took it to the then just Timothy McVeigh drove it to the federal building and blew it up. Well, as we saw, the director of the FBI, Janet Reno, like lots of people in the early days, they were looking for a John Doe number two. They were looking for a second person somehow involved in this. It wasn't just Timothy McVeigh. They even had a sketch of this guy, right? Lots and lots of people claim to have seen another person. So this is Timothy McVeigh's lawyer talking about that.
Late at night and in the afternoon, about events that happened 48 hours before in a small room in a business that only has half a dozen or fewer employees. They rent one rider a truck a day. So it's not like it's Grand Central Station or Walmart where there's 500 people going through and you might mistake one.
So he's saying, look, there's no one, like it's a sleepy little town that, you know, rents one Ryder truck a day. 48 hours go by before they talk to them. And it's not like it was from a week ago. They'd maybe had one other customer since then rent a Ryder truck. And so it's fresh in their minds. They're like, oh yeah, it was these two guys. Here's what they looked like. And then this woman here, it doesn't matter. She's a family of one of the victims. She hears that there's this other guy and that they changed the story to it just being Timothy McVeigh later on. So she goes down to the same Ryder place and asks them, well, wait, was it just Timothy McVeigh or was it some other person?
To Elliot's body shop, and I spoke to Mr. Elliot. I told him who I was, and I said, I would like for you to tell me what happened the day Tim came to rent the Ryder truck. And he said, you mean the day Tim and his friend came? And I said, Tim wasn't by himself? He said, no, ma'am.
And again, they had two mugshots. It was in all the newspapers. It was in all the news broadcasts. They're looking for two different guys. This is one of the guys that saw two different guys.
Tim McVeigh stepped out of the truck. I walked him over to, let's say, 10, 11 feet away from the truck itself. I pointed a direction downtown, which is to my right. He seemed to acknowledge where I was talking about. At that time, the gentleman walked back to the truck. I talked to him. I also noticed there was a passenger in the truck at that time.
I know for a fact Timothy McVeigh was with another individual on the morning of April 19th, right before the bombing.
So the official story was that there was two people. They had a $2 million reward. You know, like, they went to the motel where Timothy McVeigh was supposedly staying with the Ryder truck. And when the maid saw this sketch from that was supposed to be John Doe number two, she said, quote, my God, who did the sketch. It looks just like him.
The FBI's former deputy assistant director, Danny Coulson, now questions the official version. On the day of the bombing, he was in charge at the crime scene.
So even the FBI agent who was in charge of the crime scene is now thinking there's something screwy with this. This is fucked up. There's no way all these witnesses got it wrong. There was definitely another guy.
Coulson believes the FBI might not have caught everyone involved in the attack.
We know there were 24 people that were interviewed by the FBI that said they saw Mr. McVeigh on April 19th with someone else, and they had no reason to make it up. They didn't have a dog in that fight. They didn't have any reason to just to make something up. They told the agents exactly what they saw, and the agents wrote it down. If only one person had seen it, or two or three, but 24 people say, yes, I saw him with somebody else. That's pretty powerful.
So 24 different witnesses, including the people that rented the truck, claimed that there were two people. But somehow it just magically went to one, and we'll discuss perhaps maybe why that might be.
5 feet 9 inches to 5 feet 10 inches tall, weighing approximately 175 to 80 pounds, with brown hair, and a tattoo visible on his left arm below his t-shirt sleeve.
It was a perfect match. He was stopped coming across the border in San Diego from visiting his...
So this guy here is telling you what happened to his brother. His brother had some trouble with the law. He had robbed some banks, been involved in some armed robbery, but had done his time and had kind of settled down and got married and had a kid. And one day he's crossing the border from Mexico because his wife was Mexican. He gets stopped at the border. And they look up his background. They see that he used to be a bank robber. And they also look at his tattoo, and they say, oh, well, we're going to haul you in because you're violating parole. And for some, and this is in California. This is in California. For those of you in not in America, that's really far away from Oklahoma. So imagine like, I don't know, Oklahoma would be like Italy. And this happens in England, okay? And they're like, they pull you over, they get you for a parole violation in England, and they're like, oh, we have to ship you over to Italy for some reason. So for some reason, they say, we have to transfer you to Oklahoma. And he's like, all right. And he calls his brother, who's a lawyer, and says, yeah, they're transferring me to Oklahoma for some reason.
Some of his wife's family. The next thing we know, he's in Oklahoma, and he's dead 2 days later.
Jesse wanted to preserve the evidence. He filmed his brother's body. He believes interrogators beat Kenneth to death, thinking he was the mystery bomber.
He receives three massive blows to the head, so severe that it ruptured the scalp to the skull, and these were massive injuries. He was literally beaten head to toe, front to back. Even the soles of his feet had been beaten, and his throat had been slashed.
But he committed suicide. So while in federal custody for a parole violation that would have nothing to do with the FBI, you know, his judge was in California. You know, his parole officer was in California. It was California. Like, the FBI should not have been involved at all. They send them to Oklahoma City for no reason. And then they call up his family and say, oh, he committed suicide. So they get his body initially the body shows up covered in makeup. So he washes, his brother washes the makeup off and sees that he's been beat to death. And his throat has been cut. He tries to contact the FBI and get more information on it. And you can probably imagine how well that went.
Kenneth Trenity was found dead in his cell at Oklahoma City's Federal Transfer Center in August of 1995. He had been awaiting a parole violation hearing. His death was ruled a suicide. Investigators claim Trenity hanged himself. Blood was found splattered throughout his cell, and pictures reveal Trenity had numerous cuts and bruises all over his body. Both local and federal...
Looks like suicide to me. He beat himself to death. Isn't that always how people commit suicide?
Well, investigators ruled they were self-inflicted.
Those are self-inflicted wounds, guys. It's all self-inflicted. Yeah, wait till you see. This isn't even like the worst one. Hope you guys aren't squeamish. This is what he looked like before the FBI. This is what he looked like after the FBI.
What we never had was a motive for his death. People would say to you, why?
This is the brother, Jesse Trentadue, which, by the way, I didn't put because there's just so much from this guy. This guy, if you want to hear the full interview with James Corbett, I highly recommend it. It's just really long, longer than, because tonight's going to be another long one. It's more time than what we've got. But he does, he went on basically a mission. The reason why we have a lot of this information is he was a lawyer and, you know, he knew the process and had the ability to work with the system in a way that many people who don't have that background would know how to navigate. And so he started doing Freedom of Information Act requests, trying to get all the information he could, trying to figure out what the hell happened to his brother. He knew that, you know, obviously something was up. You know, he knew that his brother didn't commit suicide. That was for damn sure. And so he was just trying to figure out why the FBI was lying. And so at a certain point, again, I was still talking about it's always the same fucking people, right? Always the same people. The AG under Obama, not Loretta Lynch, but the what's it? The guy who did the Fast and Furious stuff. Why am I blanking on that? Let me see here. Obama AG. Yeah, Eric Holder. So Eric Holder, when he got some of the Freedom of Information Act requests, Obama's AG, you know, who would later become Obama's AG, Eric Holder was involved in trying to cover this up. He had emails where, and they think it's a big fucking joke. There was an email where Eric Holder says there's Trenta do's and there's Trenta don'ts. And they were talking about how they had to get rid of certain things because he was sending in too many Freedom of Information Act requests. So anyway, I recommend checking out the full interview is like over an hour long, but you can find it on CorbettReport.com. And it's pretty easy to find. I think it's on BitChute and other things too.
Why would the federal government torture, and he was tortured, and murder your brother? And we had no explanation for that. Another thing about the case that was always unexplainable was the fact that so much evidence disappeared.
My brother was supposedly found with blood-stained clothing, but when his body was turned over to the medical examiner 2 hours later, his clothes are gone. He's wearing nothing but boxer shorts. The video camera, supposedly that would monitor access to my brother, malfunctioned. The logbooks that would have shown who came and went from the institution with access to my brother either disappeared, or the pages on the date my brother was there, dates my brother was there, were torn out. The crime scene photographs disappear. The medical examiner is not allowed access to the death scene. When he finally is allowed access to the death scene 4 months later, it had been painted and cleaned up. And this is all done by the FBI and the Department of Justice. And we could never understand why this kind of resistance was coming from the government. First, they had cameras that actually showed the truck being driven up to the Murrow Building Park.
Okay, so obviously, just like Epstein, everything's, oh my God, the cameras, they all stopped working exactly when he suicided himself. And like, oh, look at that. All the evidence is, yeah, of course, obviously. But this is what happens. When you don't fucking stop it back in the 90s, it just keeps going. Because it's the same motherfuckers. It's the same motherfuckers. It's the same people doing this shit. Because no one holds them accountable. No one. So why would they stop? Why would... If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Right? Their formula works. Why would they change it? And look, this, and it's not, this is 9/11, this is Epstein, this is all this shit. It's the same fucking shit, over, and same people, over and over and over again. Nothing ever fucking happens. So then this is the, later in the interview, he's talking about how, after he realized that his, brother fit the description of John Doe number 2. And it was right in that window, the Oklahoma bombing, like that was right when it happened. You know, he had a reporter actually call him up and say, can you describe your brother to me? And he did. And he's like, holy shit. Yeah, you realize that they probably thought it was John Doe number 2 because he had the tattoo. He had a bank robbing background, which is goes along with some of the white supremacist groups at the time that they were trying to infiltrate. They would fund themselves by, you know, robbing armored cars and doing some bank robberies. Bank robberies were like way easier to do back in the 80s and 90s. And a lot of a shocking amount of bank robberies took place in the 80s and 90s. And so they were saying, you know, like, or the guy said, like, yeah, look, that's probably what happened. Is they thought your brother was John Doe number 2. And at any rate, so he starts asking, I mean, he's trying to FOIA anything and everything, and having to do with Oklahoma City. And he asks for the tapes that show the truck. Because supposedly there's a tape that shows the truck pulling up to the front of the federal building. And again, just like the Pentagon, right? There ought to be cameras showing that stuff, right? It's a federal building. They have cameras everywhere. Just like a bank or a casino or something like that. It's not like the technology didn't exist. So he starts asking for the footage.
First, they had cameras that actually showed the truck being driven up to the Murrow Building Park and the people getting out. Well, the FBI says, you know, there was only one person in that truck, and that was Tim McVeigh. Well, there was more than one person in that truck, and the other person was probably an informant. You would think that tape would have been Exhibit 1 in the McVeigh murder trial. No one's ever seen it but the government. So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, and I asked for this. I said, I want the surveillance tapes from the exterior cameras on these buildings leading on the route leading up to the Murrow Building. So the route McVeigh took that morning, these tapes were shown in that truck and who was in it with him.
And I said, I also want the surveillance tapes from the Alpha P. Murrow building. There were two cameras on the outside of that building. They would have clearly shown who was with McVeigh in that truck. Well, the FBI produces 26 tapes from the other buildings, not the Murrow building. And these tapes, at strategic moments, go blank. And not all at the same time, but it's, you know, the building furthest away goes blank for a few seconds, the tape does. The tape from the next building goes blank a little while afterwards for a few seconds, and so on, leading up to the Murrow building. So that the moment that truck was being driven by, these tapes mysteriously go blank.
So they meticulously went through all of the footage they had confiscated from all the surrounding buildings and erased the portion of the tape where the Ryder truck would have been driving up to the building. I wonder why. I wonder why.
John Doe number two.
John Doe number two.
John Doe number two.
Well, the key document, I think, for me was the January 4, 1996 teletype from the director of the FBI, Louis Free, to a number of field offices.
Although the name on the document is blacked out, the gap makes up 23 letters and spaces, the same amount as Andreas Karl Strassmeier. If correct, the document shows McVeigh made another attempt to call Strassmeier just 2 days before the bombing.
So there's some speculation that John Doe number two could be this German guy named Strassmeier, or he could just be a spook. He might not have been in the truck. But this German guy named Strassmeier magically shows up in the United States with no valid visa and starts doing what Timothy McVeigh was doing. He starts going to like white supremacist communities and militia groups and just starts talking like, hey, it would be kind of awesome to blow up some fucking federal buildings. And blow up federal building. I can't do a German accent. But this guy just comes out of fucking nowhere. And then after the bombing, and phone records show that Timothy McVeigh called the guy twice. And then after the bombing, he's escorted by CIA agents back to Germany via Mexico. They sneak him out of the United States. And the FBI puts out a notice telling people not to investigate him. And then they call there, and then to say that they interviewed him after he's safely back in Germany. They call him on the phone and basically say, so, did you do the bombing? And he was like, no. Or nine. And then they're like, oh, okay, cool, thanks, bye. And like, that's it.
It also shows a source had told the FBI that Strassmeier allegedly had a lengthy relationship with Timothy McVeigh. And the FBI knew in advance that Strassmeier was planning to leave the U.S., via Mexico.
You know, you can't look at this and come to any other conclusion, I think, any reasonable person, when you look at it in totality, you're going to conclude that Andy Strassmeier is protected. Strassmeier is a strange duck in anybody's book. There's nothing in Strassmeier's files that is routine, meets normal expectations, or is done in accordance with what we discovered were standard procedures in effect at the time.
You have Andrew Strassmeier, who's a German, who's overstayed in this country, who has expressed to a government agent, an informant, that he wants to kill government employees, blow up federal buildings, that he is a director of security at Elohim City. He wears a swastika. He's a man of mystery. And yet, even though he knows our client, even though our client tried to call him, the government's not interested in talking with him. Why?
Yeah, so they literally smuggled him back to Germany. They have no interest in talking to him. At the time, there was a lot of joint efforts going on between Israel, Germany, and the United States to combat white supremacists.
He was never interviewed by any FBI agents. He was interviewed by two assistant United States attorneys with an FBI agent present on the phone taking notes, but there was never a face-to-face, sit-down, come-to-Jesus meeting with the FBI. That never occurred. There's a lot of questions who he is, who he works for. Does he work for someone in the United States? Does he work for the federal government, or did he work for a government overseas? Did he work for the Israelis?
Uh-oh, this guy's asking too many questions. He better hope he's got life insurance, the same way Waco should have hoped that they had fire insurance.
Did he work for the Israelis? The Israelis certainly have an interest in looking at neo-Nazis, I mean, because of their history. The Germans have a significant problem with neo-Nazis in their country, and they were not happy with our investigations here. Was he working for them? I don't know the answer to it. What I do know is he wasn't just bumming around.
Yeah. So, yeah. Basically, you have this German intelligence operative who's, I mean, clearly a German intelligence operative involved, who might have been John Doe number two. And if he wasn't, John Doe number two was absolutely an intelligence operative trying to infiltrate right-wing militias and white supremacist groups. The town in particular they mentioned was Elohim. What fucking state is that? I forget. It's some little tiny, real tiny Christian identity community where he lived for a while. And it's also where Timothy McVeigh had been for a while. There's a lot of documents that basically. That basically show that almost half the town, at least during times in the 90s, were half the town was basically federal informants, and that there was a lot of interest in this town by group. The CIA had actually flown one of their reconnaissance satellites over the town for a while. So it's, you know, this is what it looked like. So does that look like John Doe number two? I mean, I don't know. Could be. Let me see if I can put them side, you know, side by side. I gotta find the sketch for John Doe number two again here. Let's see. That's not it. All right, so here's John Doe number two. Let me see if I can put them side by side here. I mean, you know, could be. Let me see if I can do a better job of this. I mean, it's possible. Who knows?
Strassmeyer is an interesting character, these documents we got from the court. It's my understanding he's a German intelligence officer. He is apparently, after the bombing, taken out of the country by a former CIA operative back to Germany. His visa, as I understand it, had expired, and no one picked him up, and he was smuggled out through Mexico and back to Germany. One of the things that may be most productive to getting at the truth was the discovery of an operation the FBI had in place since about 1991 called PATCON. P-A-T-C-O-N.
So here he's just talking about PATCON again. Basically says the same thing he said in the other interview.
Every neo-Nazi group, every group critical to the government in the United States, the plan apparently was to put informants in with all of these groups.
When we interviewed Jane Graham, who was a survivor, she said that when she went to work, it was either the day before or 2 days before, I don't remember which, she parked in the basement parking, and when she got out of her car and was walking across the parking garage, she saw three guys down there wearing coveralls and placing putty on the columns and stringing wire between the putty. Later, she picks out one of the guys from photographs and says, that's him, and it was Andreas Strassmeyer.
Strassmeyer was there listening, going over the plans. He was listening to everything. He was what they were talking about, looking.
So this woman who worked at the federal building is placing Strassmeyer at the federal building 2 days prior to, or 1 to 2 days prior to the bombing in the parking garage.
At place, pointing to things, but when they were talking, whatever they happened to finally be talking about, and when I was looking at him at that point, then he left and went over to the other side of the building so I wouldn't keep watching him. The second man that was there, who appeared to be military, he's the one that the man in charge told to put the stuff back in the car. The second man obviously was taking orders from the first man because he had wire in his hands, which I thought was telephone wire. It's that real light color, thin wire. And he also had what appeared to be gray putty.
Well, that's exactly how you string composition C4 with detcord.
So she saw guys walking around, and this will become important as we get into how ridiculous the truck bomb theory is. But she saw guys stringing up C4 in the building like a day before. And one of the guys, she says, was this German intelligence operative who might work for Israel. So, anyway, might explain why, we can't talk about we can't mention that anyone else was involved, right? Just like the USS Liberty, perhaps.
Are chilling. We'll also focus on surveillance cameras, cameras that caught the bombing on tape, and maybe the men behind the bombing. The news channel has new information tonight that there's a chance surveillance tapes could be the smoking gun evidence. Now, we asked candid questions in a rare face-to-face meeting with ATF officials close to the investigation. We learned that video collected from downtown businesses the morning of April 19th may someday be played before a jury. Officials won't say who or what exactly is on the tape. However, numerous sources have confirmed the tapes exist and that they reveal more than one bomber.
So not only do they've heard multiple people report to local media outlets that they have the tapes that the FBI has now said, oh, we can't find it. Oh, whoops, it's gone. Immediately after the bombing, you had people who had viewed the tapes who said, yeah, no, it shows there's more than one guy in that Ryder truck. One of them is definitely Timothy McVeigh, but one of them is some other guy. And in fact, the other guy seems like he's the one that sets it off because he gets out of the truck after Timothy McVeigh. And even in the official FBI documents, they refer to the suspects, plural, in the truck. They say tapes from the area show the truck detonation. See, that's the other thing, too, is it shows the detonation. It shows the actual explosion that takes out the building. So if, I don't know, you had the building rigged with C4 and you could see it explode outward from the C4 explosions, which we'll get into here in a little bit, you wouldn't want that video out, even if it was just Timothy McVeigh in that video. But it says tapes from the area show the truck detonation 3 minutes and 6 seconds after the suspects exited the truck.
Tim McVeigh was honorably discharged from the Army 3 years before the bombing, leaving behind an exemplary service record. After a brief but intense combat experience in the Persian Gulf War, McVeigh tried out for the Special Forces. He pronounced himself unable to continue just a few days into the testing and returned to his unit demoralized and, some say, a changed man.
Totally makes sense, right? Totally makes sense. His defense team couldn't even get a copy of his military record.
Defense team themselves could never obtain his full military records, and that even though they were ordered by a judge.
Where does he turn up? He turns up in Buffalo, New York. And while he's up there, he creates what's known as a legend. Now, legend is when you go undercover or you get sheep dipped. Sheep dipped means you change your identity, you change your who you work for, and become a new person. Changes his personality up there, and all of a sudden he's ranting and raving about the Turner Diaries and overthrowing the government and all this other nonsense to where they're going, this guy's a wacko. He works up there 6 months, disappears. Where do we find him again? Going into militia meetings and doing the same thing, making sure he's noticed.
We'll get a little more into that here in a second.
That man is John Doe number two, a man who, for all we know, is still on the loose, leaving open a vital question. Was it John Doe number two who actually set off the bomb, not Timothy McVeigh, as we've all been led to believe? News Channel 4 has for weeks been demanding copies of the surveillance tapes from the FBI. The federal government so far is dragging its feet. But many people in the investigation have seen the tapes, and now so has a source willing to describe to the News Channel what the tapes show. The LA Times report shows there was a surveillance camera near the corner of 5th and Harvey and another near the corner of 5th and Robinson. Federal investigators recreated the time sequence leading up to the bombing by matching the video and still photos from the surveillance cameras.
Since we can't show you the tape ourselves, we're reenacting what our source says he saw on those tapes.
As witnesses told the News Channel before, the tapes show the Ryder truck parked in front of the Murrah building where we now know the blast went off. As witnesses also told us, the tapes show two men sitting inside the Ryder truck. A man strongly resembling Timothy McVeigh gets out of the driver's side, steps down. He then appears to have dropped something on the step up into the truck. He bends down and appears to pick something up off the step. Then he turns and walks directly across 5th Street toward the Journal Record building. All this time, John Doe number 2 is still inside the Ryder truck's cab, sitting on the passenger side. Time passes. The surveillance tape is time-lapse photography. Without knowing exactly the time interval between shots, our source can't be sure how long John Doe number 2 sat in that cab. What was he doing all that time? Then the tape shows John Doe number 2 getting out of the passenger side of the Ryder truck. Again, the tape shows that a bombing witness accurately described what happened next to News Channel 4.
I'm standing in the building. And I was looked out the window, and I seen the Ryder's truck, and I seen the man get out of the Ryder's truck.
The tape shows John Doe number 2 getting out, shutting the passenger side door. He steps toward the front of the truck and is momentarily out of the frame of the surveillance camera. But shortly, he appears back in frame, walking toward the rear of the truck, still on the sidewalk in front of the Murrah building. Again, he turns east toward the front of the truck, looking toward the street. John Doe number 2 then walks diagonally across 5th Street toward the east, as if heading toward the YMCA or the intersection of 5th and Robinson. He again leaves the frame of the camera. Another camera shooting from another angle clearly shows the actual explosion that destroyed the federal building and killed 169 people.
And all of that footage is gone. All of that footage has disappeared. So let's talk about the explosion. Because according to people that were in the building at the time, there was more than one explosion. Not only that, but the type of bomb that the FBI describes is incapable of dealing out the damage that the federal building took. And that's not me just saying that. That's everyone from literally the inventor of the neutron bomb and the Air Force that tried to recreate the explosion.
Police and emergency crews are talking about moving us back because of the danger of a possibility.
And again, the official story is one guy, one bomb, right? Timothy McVeigh, bomb. That's it. One guy, one bomb.
Possibility of another explosion.
I think he said another bomb.
Another bomb. Oh
my God, another bomb.
The fire crews and the various emergency crews are trying to get in, but we keep getting reports that there may be other devices in the area.
And they will use that that trailer. You see the bucket on the back there, sort of this is how they would transport the explosive device away from this populated area to try to do something with it.
There were two unexploded devices discovered subsequent to the initial explosion.
A second bomb was found on the east side of that building. A bomb squad is on the scene. That second bomb has not exploded. We don't know quite the status yet if they've managed to defuse it, but it has been confirmed.
There have been reports of two explosive devices, unexploded explosive devices.
Two different explosive devices were found in addition to the one that went off.
Just an hour after the initial explosion, downtown Oklahoma City was shaken up again with word of another bomb, or maybe two.
They've had to back off a couple times because they found, I guess, two or three other bombs, or at least explosive devices down there that they've had to defuse.
They shut down our operation for about 20, 30 minutes because of that, and that was very frustrating because we were right at the point where we had people and we had to leave them.
The first bomb that was in the federal building did go off. It did the damage that you see right there. The second explosive was found and defused.
So there you go. Lots of reports of multiple bombs. And by the way, not just in the fog of war and the confusion of covering it. No, official reports of disposing of other bombs. The fire department has a report detailing the deactivation of other bombs.
The truck bomb just delivers an air blast. That's all it does. It's called an air blast. And when you've got 8-foot thick columns of concrete filled with rebar the size of your arm, an air blast probably won't even break one. It'll break windows. That's about it. But some of these columns were ripped up, shredded, tossed around.
Now, I looked at the building. I was on a bomb squad for a couple of years. I've worked some bombings. And I looked at the building and I knew that the damage done to that building couldn't have come from a truck with ANFO in it.
And I can tell you that the building was blown from the inside because all the debris was piled up against the General Record building clear across the parking lot.
Now that's important. If you have a bomb that's coming from a single source, like a truck, blowing up in front of a building, it's not going to throw that parts of that building the other direction. You know, it's a single source of kinetic energy. So you're going to have like a crater. You're going to have the blast pattern is going to go outward away from the crater. It's not going to throw walls over itself in the other opposite direction. Unless, of course, you have explosives inside the building meant to take out the 8-foot thick concrete walls that the truck bomb would have no way of actually destroying.
The thing that I experienced, I was sitting there signing some papers for Ruth. I felt the building start shaking, and never had anything like that happen before, and I just kind of froze. And then the lights went out. It didn't get totally dark because the whole front of the building was glass. The lights went out, and then the debris started falling on my desk. And then something hit me in the back of the head and knocked me out before the truck bomb went off. What that tells you is that there were other explosive devices in the building that actually brought the building down.
That guy was in the building when it went up. And it's saying that there were things blowing up before the truck bomb went off.
Building started to sway back and forth. It was going back and forth. And I had sat there and I thought, no, it doesn't feel like an earthquake. And I was, you know, I was kind of stunned. And then about 7 or 8 seconds later, I felt this explosion, and you could feel the concrete floor actually rising from underneath you. You could feel it coming up from the inside.
So she says she heard the first explosion, and then there was a noticeable pause. And then another explosion hit that actually lifted up the concrete floor that she was on, which would not happen. There wouldn't be a secondary, like if you had a truck bomb, you blew up a truck bomb, it wouldn't somehow create a, you know, it doesn't, like concrete's not explosive. So it wouldn't create a secondary explosion. The local college had a one of these things called the seismograms, or you know, like the earthquake machines, right? Detected three distinct disturbances. Two separate explosions, and then the third, the building collapsing. There was also a similar bombing in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia. Let me see what if I did I close that tab? Yeah, I closed the tab. Let me look this up again real quick. Yeah, this was, okay. Yeah, 1996, the Khabar Towers bombing. Now, when this bomb went off, this bomb was something like a factor of 10 times stronger than the bomb that was in the truck, in the Ryder truck. To give you an idea, I think the difference in crater size, like the crater underneath the Ryder truck was, do I have it here? I might have it here. I forget. It was small enough to where they literally just covered up with plywood. You know, like it wasn't like some deep hole. This explosion here, which only took off the front facade of the building. It didn't collapse the building. It didn't blow out like, you know, the internals of it. This building was way weaker than the federal building. It was, you know, some chintzy Saudi Arabia building. It left a crater 85 feet wide and 35 feet deep. And 35 feet deep. And this is all the damage it did to that building. Because these types of explosives aren't very effective against buildings. And again, this was filled with 5,000 pounds of big dick, like actual explosives. Not like fertilizer bombs. And this is all it was able to do. Because the majority of the explosion is going to be air. It's going to be forcing air. Which will still, I mean, look, air still does a lot of damage. Like, look at a tornado, right? But it doesn't do what happened to the Oklahoma City Federal Building. The other problem is the type of bomb that the FBI describes, the type of bomb they say that Timothy McVeigh made, would have filled the entire downtown area with like ammonia gas, like poisonous gas. Like all the first responders would have been hospitalized. And we know that because a bomb like they described was used by a bunch of communists back in 1970. It was the Sterling Hall bombing. So a bunch of communists did the kind of bomb that they are saying Timothy McVeigh did. By the way, almost none of them like did any kind of jail time for doing this. Like this is all that happened. So the building got like most of the damage of the building was broken windows. Like the structure itself was fine. It just blew up all the windows. And because they're commies and not the scary right-wingers, I think like the most time that any of these fuckers did was like 3 years. So, anyway. But all the first responders, because of the poisonous gas, ended up in the hospital.
I spent over 30 years in the Air Force. Most of that was in research and development. I went to a two-year graduate program, 8 quarters of armament engineering graduates, the first course that was ever set up. And after that, I worked at the Blissey Research Laboratories at Aberdeen, which was 2 years of hands-on work designing, developing continuous rod warheads for the Blue Mark missile and other weapon systems. Well, the truck bomb, even though it was fairly massive, it was somewhat removed from some of the structures that were damaged. It clearly had some what you call Broussard's damage, where the blast pressure was way above what you would expect to get from the truck at that distance.
Broussard's damage is that caused by an explosive whose blast wave is powerful enough to shatter and destroy the material affected. The problem with the failed columns at the Murrah Building is at that distance, the air blast from an Anvil bomb would have been 10 times less powerful than what was needed to dissolve the concrete and cut the rebar. Those columns, had they failed due to air blast, should have broken with sharp chunks of concrete connected by rebar, not sheared off at critical points. Broussard's damage indicates contact explosives placed directly on the beams.
So they identified that some critical beams had explosives directly placed, and literally every explosives expert who has looked at this, every one of them, except for the FBI's, who we'll get into in a little bit, every single one of them have said, like, yeah, that truck bomb can't possibly have done that. In fact, you have parts of the explosion like turning corners, destroying columns behind columns that aren't destroyed, which doesn't make any sense at all. These were definitely columns that were destroyed by explosives that were strategically placed on the columns to create a collapse. They killed kids. They killed kids because they hate white Christians. And they didn't stop, so they just kept killing more kids. Like, no one stopped them. No one held them to account, so they just kept doing it. You know, first they killed some kids at Ruby Ridge. No one does anything. So they killed some kids at Waco. No one does anything. They killed some kids at Oklahoma City. No one does anything. And they killed some kids at 9/11. No one does anything. Same fucking people. Same people.
Released a report today condemning the FBI crime lab for mishandling evidence and for slanting its analysis. The report is expected to specifically criticize the lab's handling of the Oklahoma City and World Trade Center bombing cases. It was the allegations of FBI whistleblower Frederick Whitehurst that sparked that investigation.
The Oklahoma City case will get a lot of attention because what the inspector general goes on to at some length to say in his analysis of agent testimony in some of the pretrial stages is that one agent in particular made sort of seat of the pants estimates about the Oklahoma City bomb, but then couched them in his reports, in his written reports, as being the result of scientific evidence.
The FBI laboratory has built itself for many, many years as the premier forensic laboratory in the world. The people that did the things they did knew doggone well what they were doing.
The only expert to disagree with all the other experts that said, yeah, this truck bomb couldn't possibly have done this, gets ratted out by a coworker who then gets fired, of course. And the OIG, remember the OIG during Trump? The OIG report's going to come out and all the heads will roll. Nah, nothing happened. Well, nothing happened back then either. The OIG is just a fucking joke. The OIG is just there to, like, make you feel like there's someone watching the watchers. It's... yeah. If only that were true. Yeah, so then the Air Force decided, well, we're going to try to replicate this. And they made a truck bomb. And they discovered that not only was the blast not enough to do the kind of damage that you would expect to see if that kind of truck bomb was capable of doing what happened to the Oklahoma City federal building. But almost all of the explosive force goes straight up. So it just blasts up the top like a fucking Roman candle. In their report, they state it must be concluded that the damage at the Murrah Federal Building is not the result of the truck bomb itself, but rather due to other factors, such as locally placed charges within the building itself, as can be seen from the tests. No investigation. No one looking into that.
The explosive that they disarmed last night was even larger.
Were you there a minute ago when somebody yelled they thought they'd seen a second device?
Yes, sir. We were close to the parking area trying to recover a victim.
Fire department confirms they did find a second device. A second bomb was disarmed. That's just unexploded charges that didn't go off when they blew up the building.
Hour two of the bombing, the most significant event that happened is when they said they found other bombs in the building. The second most significant event was that they moved everybody back and held them back. There were still people alive trapped in the building, but they came in with two trucks and backed them up to the Murrah building, and a bunch of these guys dressed in blue jackets with no letters on the back started taking boxes of files out and putting them on this truck.
We were told by a blonde female agent that there were files so serious to the government that until those files were located, there would not be any recovery effort.
If you remember the Whitewater investigation in Arkansas, all the paperwork was stored in the Murrah building. They had FBI agents over in the fields to the west of the Murrah building picking up paper almost all day long.
Isn't that convenient? All the documents for the Whitewater investigation on the Clintons. Stored in the building that was rigged to be blown up. Agents show up on the scene, stop, like while they're trying to unbury buried still alive people. Agents show up, tell them you need to leave the area. You need to cease rescue efforts. These files that we've come to retrieve are more important to the security of the United States. That's all you got to say, right? And it's all tied to national security. So they collect a bunch of documents while people are like screaming and dying in the rubble.
The second explosive was found and defused.
I think he said another bomb.
The Justice Department is reporting that a second explosive device has been found.
They then found a third device, which was also larger than the first.
And I see another bomb truck going, so apparently they're going to try to get out that third bomb.
Then there's this photo. Someone with a conscience leaked out this photo of a Ryder truck housed at a military base. Prior to the bombing, the Army responded and said, "Oh, yeah, well, we did have a Ryder truck, and we were researching blowing up truck bombs, but it has nothing to, like they actually say in their statement, but it has nothing to do with the terror attack in Oklahoma City." I'm sure we can trust them, right? We can trust them. They've given us no reason to not trust them, right? Why wouldn't we trust them?
We're still working the case with Janie Davis and David Hoffman, two Oklahoma City police officers, and one of them, it was one of the first ones in the building, and he saw some things in the building. He saw the biggest damage to the building was the pit, which was in the back of the building and went down like two or three floors. He saw all of that, you know. That never came out in the news. It wasn't part of the investigation. It didn't count. In other words, if it didn't fit the mold that the Department of Justice under Janet Reno set for the FBI, then it wasn't put in the case.
All right, we're going to talk about this guy. Terrence, what was his last name? Terrence, you know, spoiler alert, he doesn't live very long. Terrence Yeke. So Terrence Yeke was one of the first cops on the scene. He was giving some woman a ticket when the explosion happened. He rushed down there to start pulling people out of the rubble. Worked all day, ended up getting hospitalized. And I'll let his wife explain some of his behavior after that.
As soon as they loaded him into the car, he got very upset, started to cry a little bit, and said, Tanya, it's not what they're saying it is. They're not telling the truth. They're lying about what's going on down there. And I did try to press him a little bit, ask him questions, but he didn't seem very willing to talk about it. It was just kind of a comment, you know, it's not what they're portraying it to be. About two or three days later, after the bombing, he had asked me to take him down to the site. And mind you, Terry couldn't even walk. He really was not in any shape to go down there. But he kept insisting we needed to go back down there. Said that we needed to go at night when we could not be seen. And people would just recognize us easily. I didn't understand the reason for that, but I didn't ask a lot of questions either because he just seemed unwilling to give a lot of information. We did go down there, probably between 9:30, 10 o'clock, and he said that we were going to go look underneath where the daycare had been. There was something he wanted to see under there and get a picture if possible.
Now, just because the audio is so bad, to catch you up, he comes home. He's really upset. He's telling his wife that that the story that they're telling you is not the real story. Something's not right. We need to go back to the scene and snap some photos. I need to get in the building. And so we need to go at night when there's not as many people around because they're trying to keep people away from some of this stuff. And so she's like, all right, I guess. Well, let's do it.
As we went down there, we were stopped. And I can't remember which personnel it was, but I know definitely it was either ATF or FBI. I just cannot recall what the name was on the back of his jacket, but it was one of the two. And Terry had attempted to badge his way through, and the guy told him no. And he said something a little more specific, like, you know you're not supposed to be back down here, something along the lines that made me realize the two of them recognized each other, and the interaction was very antagonistic. I think had I not been with Terry, he would have said a little more to the man, and maybe been a little more forceful about getting through, but it seemed like he thought better about it since I was with him, and we left. About 15 days after the bombing happened, I got a call from his supervisor, Lieutenant Joanne Randall. And she was being pretty hostile, pretty aggressive, and asked me where Terry was, told her he was not there. And she said, you tell Terry that if he doesn't get that other report in, that he's going to be reprimanded if he does not get that in by the end of the night.
Who was this?
This is Lieutenant Joanne Randall.
Mm-hmm.
And this was his supervisor, direct supervisor at the time. Now, let me give you a little filler in there. In this time frame, Terry had written a 9-page report. I know that he wrote a 9-page report. I saw it. This is the only report, however, that I've ever asked him to read that he did not let me. I didn't understand the reason for that at the time. It was, you know, I've ridden with my husband, you know, on ride-alongs. We talk a lot about what had happened at work. You know, I've read reports about the prostitutes on 9th and Francis, you know. I mean, just meaning that nothing was really all that sacred. You know, if I asked about it, usually he was pretty forthcoming in telling me about it. This time it was an absolute no.
So he told his wife that that she couldn't read the report that he'd written up on the bombing. He'd written a 9-page report, and he had turned it in. His superiors started harassing her and saying, "You need to tell Terry to turn in a different report." He told other friends that he had evidence that he was storing in a storage locker that he was going to go get. He came to her house really nervous one night, put a VCR in the back of her car, and said that he would need that later. And then one day, he tells a friend that he's going to be meeting for dinner. "I have to go out to this storage unit first, and it's going to take me a while because I have feds following." This is a cop telling another cop this. "I have feds following me, and I'm going to have to lose them." That's the last time anyone that knew him saw him alive.
Morning of May 8 of 1996, at 7 a.m., his vehicle was found in a spot just behind me by a resident living up this road no more than a mile away. It was from 7 a.m. until 6 p.m. that the car would sit here, full of blood, and according to Terry's sister Vicky, there was actually blood in between the window panes in the back of the vehicle. In addition to the blood, there was an unidentified knife found in the bottom of the glove box, along with razor blades, the car keys, and the windows rolled up tight. The car was locked. Terry's body was nowhere to be found. Until later that evening, between 7 and 8 p.m., OCPD helicopters, in addition to the Canadian County Sheriff, as well as El Reno Police, would have a large search party looking for Terry's body no more than a half a mile from where we're standing. It is important to note how Yakey is supposed to have killed himself. He was said to have slit his wrists and neck, causing him to nearly bleed to death in his car and then miraculously climb over a barbed wire fence. He then was purported to have walked over 1.25 mile distance through a nearby field, eventually shooting himself in the head at an unusual angle. Startlingly, no weapon was found at the scene of the body, no investigation was conducted, no fingerprints taken, and no interviews with family members or friends were conducted to try and determine why Yakey would have been suicidal, or if he had in fact been suicidal at all. Instead, the conclusion that Yakey's death was a suicide was reached immediately without an autopsy.
He started having problems with not only at work, but his apartment got broke into, his car got broke into, things were stolen out of his house. He had accumulated reports, evidence, I don't know what at all, but he was going to take it out to a mini storage in El Reno. And he left one night, and he told a friend of his that they were going to go out to dinner. He says, "I got to run out and put some stuff in mini storage. And as soon as I shake these feds that are following me, I'll be back and we'll go to dinner." Well, he never came back. Instead, he was found the next day by a Canadian County Sheriff's deputy. Well, they found his car first, and then they found him in a field near the El Reno Penitentiary. The damage to his body was obviously a torture homicide. It was obvious. But what intrigued me the most, that he had several cuts on both of his wrists, inside both elbows, both jugular veins. He'd been beaten. He had ligature marks around his neck. He had handcuff marks on his hands, on his wrists. And he had a small caliber bullet wound that started above on the right-hand side of his temple and exited low on his cheek. with no powder burns.
Exactly how those three Clinton bodyguards died, by the way. That's the exact, like, literally the exact execution style bullet wound that the three ATF agents that were former Clinton bodyguards that died at Waco, that's the literally the exact wounds they died from. So, but he committed suicide. No autopsy, no investigation. They didn't recover a weapon. You know, you shoot yourself in the head like that, which, first of all, like, just imagine the angle of that, just trying to do that. Like, why would you even do it that way? But if you did, the gun would be, like, right there. Because you're not going to get up and walk away from that. His car was full of blood. He had handcuff marks. He had rope burns on his body. He was sliced up head to toe. And yet somehow he did all those wounds to himself in his own car. And then walked like a mile and a half after climbing over a barbed wire fence. And then shot himself in the head, and then his gun vanished. Like, so yeah, he was murdered. And the VCR that was in the back of his wife's car was magically gone the next day.
One of the things that surprised me was that there was no autopsy performed. The other thing that really bothered me was we were being told that Terry was high on drugs and drunk. And, of course, the medical examiner's office did a report on Terry and his injuries, which was really not an autopsy, but just an overview. And it showed that his BAC was zero, meaning no blood alcohol content. There was no drugs in his system. It bothered me that they didn't treat Terry like a police officer like he was. He was a good guy.
Suicide. And it might have happened to any of them. This guy said that an FBI agent threatened him.
I was told by an FBI agent, that due to comments that I'd made, that people like me often ended up dead, and he'd be careful what I said if I was him. And in the way that he put it forth, I felt like it was a threat.
A threat I would have taken seriously after, I mean, again, they just killed 17 kids, something like 70-something adults, and then anyone that got in the way. I mean, they're just getting warmed up. So then you have this little tidbit. This woman was a federal informant. She was involved with the group in Elohim, the Christian Identity people. She had a deal with the feds where she was regularly ratting them out for stuff. And she claims that she heard that German guy and Timothy McVeigh talking specifically about the bombing. And they didn't do it. They did nothing. And one of the reporters trying to research this case called her up and asked her about, hey, you know about this German guy?
Tell me about his personality. One time we're talking about relationships and things. And then he says he didn't want to settle down with anyone.
He didn't want to settle down with anyone because he wanted to go blow up federal buildings. So she went out, she went public with her information. She took a lie detector test and passed it. I mean, it's not admissible in court, but, you know, it is what it is.
It wasn't until after I left the case, some months later, that I know that FBI headquarters told them to close down the investigation on Loam City, which has some very significant connections to Mr. McVeigh and to previous bombing attempts. So I don't know why they did that. That's something that, and it's very unusual. And never in my career did I ever have FBI headquarters tell me not to investigate something. They would often suggest things to do or courses of action to follow or other leads we may have missed, but I never had them ever say, don't investigate that part of the case. That was a total aberration to me.
And again, that was the FBI agent that was in charge of the crime scene initially.
Other documents obtained by 2020 show that someone called the executive secretariat's office at the Justice Department in Washington and said the Morrow building had been bombed. But this was 24 minutes before the blast.
So you had, again, this is similar to 9/11, where you had phone calls reporting that Building 7 had collapsed before, you know, it had collapsed. So you have phone calls going into the Fed saying that there was a bombing 24 minutes before the bombing. You had the governor's brother writing a novel where a federal building in Oklahoma City gets bombed by a guy named Tom McVeigh.
And apparently, before the bombing, Governor Frank Keating's brother, Mark, had been working on a novel about a terrorist bombing in Oklahoma City. Stranger still, one of the characters in the novel was named Thomas McVeigh.
So there you go with that. You had bomb squad vehicles that were spotted across the street from the federal building. You also had ATF, no ATF agents died. Remember, this is an ATF building, right? No ATF agents died. There was a first responder that asked one of the ATF agents who was at the scene, like, oh my God, you guys okay? How many did you lose? And he said, none. He said, what do you mean none? He said, we got a page this morning telling us not to come in. Just like 9/11, right?
The Horse Patrol, interestingly, was a very small unit and was assisted by the county reserve mounted patrol unit. For whatever reason, on the morning of the bombing, they had been assigned and had already met at the Oklahoma City Equine Canine Facility and had prepared their horses, their tack, and uniforms to go downtown for crowd control. Rarely, very rarely would they go down and patrol or work the downtown area for crowd control for anything.
So the mounted police that almost never do any kind of crowd control downtown, there was nothing planned for that day, just happened to be deployed and ready to go for crowd control that morning.
And on those questions of whether there were others, whether there were others that assisted him, and whether there were others on with him in Oklahoma City on the morning of April the 19th, there were spikes. The operator said the spikes indicated that his answers were deceptive. That he
So I kind of skipped ahead here. So this is Timothy McVeigh's lawyer. And Timothy McVeigh said that he didn't work with anyone else. Timothy McVeigh claimed that he did it all himself. When he was talking to his lawyers, at least, he would say this. And his lawyers had him take a polygraph test. And when asked if he worked alone, and he would say yes, deception would be detected in those answers by the person administering the polygraph test.
Is to say he was lying. That in most of those cases where he said he was alone, he wasn't alone. There were others with him.
But now let's get to the fun part. This is an excerpt published in the New York Times. This is an excerpt of a letter that Timothy McVeigh wrote to his sister. You guys are going to love this. This is a letter dated October 20th, 1993. October 20th, 1993. So this is a couple years before the Oklahoma City bombing. Grandpa McVeigh saw this. He never knew why, but one day I showed up at his door, freezing outside, in only sweatpants, and in total complete breakdown. Gramps, I'm sure, never told anyone about that day, and I respect him greatly for that, as I spent about an hour upstairs losing it. It was almost suicide at that point, but rage, but denial, but acceptance. All these feelings were battling for control. Now here's what led to my current life. It all revolves around my arrival at Fort Bragg for Special Forces. We all took intelligence, psychological, and adeptness, and a whole battery of other tests out of a group of 400. One day in formation, 10 Social Security numbers were called out, no names, and told to leave formation. Mine was one. The 10 of us were told that out of the select group of 400, we had scored the highest on certain tests. We had been selected because of our intelligence, physical makeup, 165 pounds, 6 feet being ultimate warrior type. I was only slightly off, 160 pounds, 6 foot 1 and a half. And physical abilities. We were to feel special, part of a hand-picked group. We were all asked to volunteer, talk about peer pressure, to do some, quote, work for the government on the domestic as well as international front, end quote. What I learned next, both from the briefings and from the questions and private talks included, number one, we would be helping the CIA fly drugs into the U.S. to fund many covert operations. Number two, military consultants were to work hand in hand with civilian police agencies to quiet anyone whom was deemed a security risk. We would be government paid assassins. Number three, many other details to verify these last two, see the enclosed article or watch again the movie Lethal Weapon. It also gives you new insight on things like Waco, etc. They were murdered by hitmen. That's his letter to his sister. That's Timothy McVeigh's words, published in the New York Times. Now, what we call this when you have a military, any military personnel that they want to have deep cover. This is literally exactly what they do. They have someone join the military, join the special forces, but on paper it looks like they've left the military entirely. They've been doing this for a long time. On the record, this is an admitted practice. There's even a term for it. It's called sheep dipped. Sheep dipped is an intricate army devised process by which a man who is in the service as a full career soldier or officer agrees to go through all the legal and official motions of resigning from the service. Then, rather than actually being released, his records are pulled from the Army personnel files and transferred to a special Army intelligence file. Substitute, but nonetheless real appearing records are then processed. And the man leaves, quote unquote, the service. He is encouraged to write to friends and give a cover reason why he got out. He goes to his bank and charge card services and changes his status to civilian and does the hundreds of other official things and personal things that any man would do if he really had gotten out of the service. Meanwhile, his real army records are kept in secrecy, but not forgotten. This is a practice they've been doing since Vietnam. It's that way. If you're a spy and you've been caught, you got plausible deniability. The reasons why they would want to do this is you know, it's super obvious.
Restricted from deploying troops in Laos by the 1962 Geneva Accords, 48 Air Force personnel were instead sheep-dipped and deployed in Laos as civilian employees of Lockheed to service a bombing radar installation there. But was McVeigh sheep-dipped? By its very definition, this process is designed to be hidden from public view. Under such an operation, McVeigh's resignation, paperwork, even his personal life, would all look exactly as it should if he had genuinely been discharged from the military. Even more frustratingly, the sources of information that could potentially prove that McVeigh was in fact sheep-dipped are being deliberately kept from the public. Take the testimony of Terry Nichols. He is serving an unprecedented 161 consecutive life sentences for his part in the bombing at ADX Florence, a supermax prison in Colorado where he shares a cell block with Ramzi Youssef and Ted Kaczynski. In 2007, he provided a sworn deposition to attorney Jesse Trendu where he stated, "In December of 1992, Timothy McVeigh told me that while he was serving in the U.S. Army, he had been recruited to carry out undercover missions." McVeigh again told the same story to one of his fellow inmates on death row, David Paul Hammer.
McVeigh told me and another inmate here that he was actually an agent working for a guy he called the Major. And he allegedly met this man when he reported to for special trainings duty. And he was told to wash out his special training and asked to accept what was called black ops operations. And he would be working as an independent person as a part of, and that he would recruit people to be in his unit. According to McVeigh, this association went on for several years from the end of 1992 and throughout the days of the bombing of the Murrow Building on April 19th, 1995.
So he was working as a sheep-dipped operative the entire time. I think it's pretty obvious to anyone who's not insane or retarded or both, Timothy McVeigh was a government asset. He associated with other government assets, you know, including that German guy. The building was rigged with explosives. The truck was just for show. Timothy McVeigh was trying to entrap members of right-wing militias, apparently failed to do so, and so they went through with it anyway. By law, after they execute someone that's been given the death penalty, in the case of Timothy McVeigh, it was by lethal injection, they have to give an autopsy. Timothy McVeigh, who never asked for anything real, like he didn't fight the case really at all. I think the entire case was 3 weeks long. He didn't ask for an appeal. The only thing he did fight for was to not have an autopsy performed after he was executed. And yet another unusual step by the government, right? They granted him that. So there was no autopsy performed. One of the witnesses, a female reporter that was one of the witnesses, when they do executions in America, they have like a, there's like a glass window where there's a, like almost like a mini theater that witnesses have to watch it, you know, being done through this glass window. It's like, you know, one-way glass, you know, mirror glass type stuff, right? And one of the reporters in the room said after he'd been administered the shot, she thought she could still see him breathing shallowly. The jail also later admitted in another article that the hearse that was filmed by news organizations leaving the facility was a decoy and that he wasn't in the hearse. So we don't even know if he's dead. He kept telling the other prisoners that were on death row with him that they were just going to inject him with something fake, and that he was doing this for his country. Now, there's been a lot made about this tape, and I was kind of hoping I'd have some different news for you guys. But there's this tape here of a soldier who looks a lot like him on a base in 1993. There was a guy scouting locations for a film who just was shooting the inside of a Bradley tank. And just happened to get like a couple seconds of this soldier kind of cruising around inside there. And he does look a lot like Timothy McVeigh. But unfortunately, the quality is so bad. What I did was I found some AI, you know, biometric AI software that will compare two photos and give you a probability of whether or not they're the same person. And I was like, this is perfect. You know, we didn't have this technology before. It's always been disputed whether or not this is him. I can feed this photo into the software and maybe finally get an answer. So I fed this frame, which is really, the quality is really craptastic, into the software along with known photos of Timothy McVeigh. And unfortunately, it was all inconclusive. It gave a 51% chance that it was him, which sounds like, oh, that's better than half, you know. But it really, to give you an idea, every other photo that I compared, even like the shittier quality ones, usually scored closer to 75%. If I knew both photos were him, right? But this one only scored a 51. Now, I'd like to find a high-res version of this photo and conduct the same test. I also, funny enough, ran it through another AI, a known photo of Timothy McVeigh, that is supposed to then search the internet for photos of that person. And it actually came up with some like German guy that looked a lot like him. But let me see if I saved it. Because it looked a lot like him. I was like, holy shit. But I really doubt it's him. Is it here? Oh, no, I don't know. Maybe I didn't save it. I might not have saved it. Let me see. I'm going to look one more place. No, looks like I didn't save it. Sorry, guys. It wasn't him, though. It was like some weird German artist. So anyway, a lot of people might be thinking, well, what was the point of this? You know? Like, what would be the point of doing this kind of terrorist attack? Like, why would the deep state, like, what would they hope to accomplish by letting this happen? Like, it's one thing if they're trying to frame white supremacist groups so that they can say, oh yeah, you know, like they look what they did, so we can make a big example of them and arrest everybody. But why, when no one's taken the bait, why would they go through with it? I mean, there's the obvious, you know, we had the Clinton documents, but I mean, there's way subtler ways of getting rid of documents than blowing up a damn building. To me, that just seems more like a, how can we maximize, you know, this kind of an event? You know, never let a good crisis go to waste kind of a thing. Well, it's simple. It's simple.
Bombing in Oklahoma City was an attack on innocent children and defenseless citizens. And I will not allow the people of this country to be intimidated by evil cowards.
Case closed.
So yeah, that was them demolishing the what was left of the building. But here's why. Prior to the Oklahoma City bombing, they tried to pass what was called the Omnibus Counterterrorism Act of 1995. And what that would do is it was basically like the Patriot Act Part 1. It was introduced by Joe Biden, by Dianne Feinstein, by Chuck Schumer. You know, the same motherfuckers that are in charge today, the same fucking people. They tried to tried to get this passed in 1995, but there was actually enough of a pushback on it that they weren't able to get people to buy onto it. In fact, you can find an entire hour-long episode of Bill Cooper where they're doing letter writing campaigns and then later another episode where they're celebrating defeating it. You know, before this happened. Well, after this happened, they just renamed it. They renamed it to the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. Here's Joe Biden talking about it, telling people, you got to vote for this.
But if an emergency wiretap is good enough for John Gotti, why is it not good enough for the Unabomber? The emergency wiretap is good enough for John Gotti. Why is it not good enough for some wacko who blows up or is about to blow up a federal building in Wilmington, Delaware, or Washington, D.C.?
You hear that? We should be able to warrantlessly wiretap people for pre-crime. That's literally what he was pushing.
But if an emergency wiretap is good enough for John Gotti, why is it not good enough for the Unabomber? The emergency wiretap is good enough for John Gotti. Why is it not good enough for some wacko who blows up or is about to blow up a federal building in Wilmington, Delaware, or Washington, D.C.?
But guess what? The right wing went along with it too. Here's Bob Dole.
And over the past month, we've worked in a bipartisan manner to craft what will surely be the toughest anti-terrorism bill ever to become law. This week, to honor the memory of those who suffered in Oklahoma, the Congress will send to President Clinton this landmark bipartisan anti-terrorism bill. It has the support of the Republican governor of Oklahoma, Frank Keating, and Oklahoma's Democrat Attorney General, Drew Edmondson.
And notice how he cited the Oklahoma City bombing. Just like, once again.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I certainly agree that we are facing a more dangerous period than we faced in Oklahoma City.
That was before he was confirmed. He said that we are facing a more dangerous period now, today, than they were during the Oklahoma City bombing. Well, now he's in charge. What does he have to say?
During President Biden's first week in office, he directed the administration to undertake an assessment of the domestic terrorism threat and then to use that assessment to develop the national strategy being released today. Our intelligence and law enforcement agencies undertook that assessment in the first several weeks of this administration. In March, they concluded that domestic violent extremists pose an elevated threat to the homeland in 2021. Our experience on the ground confirms this. The number of open FBI domestic terrorism investigations this year has increased significantly. According to an unclassified summary of the March intelligence assessment, the two most lethal elements of the domestic violence extremist threat are racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists and militia violent extremists. In the FBI's view, the top domestic violent extremist threat comes from racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists, specifically those who advocated for the superiority of the white race. The March assessment concluded that the militia violent extremist threat which is describes as those who, quote, take overt steps to violently resist or facilitate the overthrow of the United States government in support of their belief that the United States government is purportedly exceeding its constitutional authority, also increased last year and will almost certainly continue to be elevated throughout 2021. Particularly concerning is the March assessment's observation that the threat from lone offenders or small cells poses significant detection and disruption challenges because of those actors' capacity for independent radicalization to violence, ability to mobilize discreetly, and access to firearms. The domestic violent extremist threat is also rapidly evolving. As FBI Director Wray has noted, we continue to observe actors driven by a diverse set of violent motivations, sometimes personalized and developed from a mix of violent ideologies. Developments in technology exacerbate the overall threat. Today, people may be drawn to social media and then to encrypted communications channels. There, they may interact with like-minded people across the country and indeed the world who want to commit violent attacks. And they may then connect with others who are formulating attack plans as well as mustering the resources, including firearms and explosives, to execute them. Technology has amplified and enabled transnational elements of the threat.
So there you go. You are the number one threat. PatCon is back on the table. Don't think that it's not. They're saying, look, it's the same motherfuckers saying the same fucking things and doing the same fucking things. Nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. Look at all that evidence that, look, just in the last two cases we talked about. Look at all the evidence that obviously something was up, something major, and not even speculative evidence. Obvious evidence that something was up with the Oklahoma City bombing. Super obvious. On the record, obvious. Lots of missing tapes and documents, obvious. Even former FBI agents saying, this is obvious, obvious. No press covers it. And even if they did, no one would do anything. Waco, same exact thing. Tons and tons and tons and tons of on-video evidence. No one's in trouble because of that. No one's even in trouble when these documents disappear. Why wouldn't they disappear? Why would you keep records at all if you were the FBI? What's going to happen if you lose everything? Nothing. Literally nothing. What's to prevent them from just disappearing people at this point? Nothing. You think that doesn't happen? Of course it does. Just ask that cop that they suicided in that field. Just ask all those people that died in the Oklahoma City bombing, or in Waco, or at Ruby Ridge. Or at the World Trade Center, for that matter. and whatever's next, because fuck, why fuck up a good thing, you know? Why change up the formula? It works. So anyway, that's part three of the healing hate. Da, 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 da. White supremacists trying to take over the Capitol. Indivisible healing hate. All right, let me take a look at super chats. Or hyper chats, or I don't know what they call them. All right, Quebec with the big dick money, $100. Let's see here. I gotta load some new ones here.
My bitch better have my money.
Regrettably, I have to work tomorrow. I'll have to catch the upload. Well, I appreciate that. Uncle Teddy just sends $5 in a shekel icon. Appreciate that. My cute little friend, $25. Appreciate that. So if we move out of the cities, are we going to get annihilated like those Branch Davidians? I mean, look, that's a possibility. But if you live in the cities, you might get annihilated like those people in the Oklahoma City, you know, building, or the people at the World Trade Center. If you're going to get annihilated, you're going to get annihilated. I have more to say about this topic that leads me to believe it's preferable to be out of the city. I can't speak with specificity about that. I will say, well, I'm trying to think of a way to put it. I don't know. Oh, by the way, the new shirt is I listed that. It's on the the video info. So get it while it's still available. And I'll tell you what, that's the new shirt is partially the answer I have for that. Pebble in the pond, $5. Appreciate that. It's incredible to see this deep dive into healing the hate. I've been looking forward to this part. Yeah, it's just funny because they don't talk. They just have these fucking lying sacks of shit who were involved in engineering these tragedies that they are now blaming on basically Christian white boomers, and then trying to say that's, you know, somehow tied. You know, Timothy McVeigh is somehow, you know, inspired January 6th. It's just so disgusting. It's so disgusting, but it's a great opportunity for a lot of people on the right who don't know a lot about this stuff because it happened so long ago. And so it's, at this point, it's a history class you're not going to get. It's another reason why you need to homeschool your kids, because this is literally the kind of history you should be teaching kids right out the gate. Because it matters. It'll change the way they see the world. It'll change the way they think. Don't think, oh, my kid's too young for this. Are the kids in elementary schools all around the country that have to watch required Holocaust class shit? Are they too young for that? I learned all about the Revolutionary War and the Civil War and all that stuff when I was like 10, probably younger. They're not too young for this stuff. The younger, the better. This is the kind of history you need to be teaching your kids. They need to understand how the world works so they don't have to unprogram themselves just to understand what the hell's going on. And it's better that they learn this stuff now and it's a normal thing because, look, there's so many people that get broken when they have to undo the programming. In both directions, there's some people that head in the sand, right? They can't hear this stuff because they can't make it through the day without just, you know, wanting to slit their wrists or whatever. And then there's like the psychos that just go off the deep end and think everything's fake and nothing's real. And they're just as useless to us. You want your kid to know about reality, and this is the reality of the world. You think the ruling class when they create their future leaders, they don't tell them how the world works, how it really works? And you don't think that, I mean, don't you think that's one of the massive advantages they give their children? Give it to yours. Electrical tape, $7. Appreciate that. Since we are finding it hard to create a single word to describe the similarities between Satanists and libertarians, do you think words in terms like amoralist, political Satanist would do the rhetorical trick? Or are those rubbish as well? None of them make me, none of them tickle my I don't know, my brain, my word bone. I don't know how to put it. So, yeah. But that maybe, clearly I'm the wrong person to ask. My rhetoric bone, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's got to be some other term. I'm sure there's got to be some term. In the meantime, just call them Satanists. How about that? Just call them Satanists. If they say I'm a libertarian, oh, you're a Satanist. I didn't know that. Well, I didn't know you were a Satanist. Just don't be a weirdo about it. Just like say it casually. Maybe that's just the way to do it. Right? I don't know you're a Satanist. In the meantime, at least. I mean, I'm okay with it. I'm actually okay with it. Or even just Luciferian. I mean, that's basically it. I guess that would, and I'm sure other people have already recommended that who are screaming at their screens right now. Luciferian sounds good. I mean, because that way Satanist sounds a little too, I mean, it's accurate, but Luciferian makes it's a different word. And it sounds kind of like libertarian. But, why try to mix it up? Just call them Luciferians. Oh, you're Lucifer. Oh, you see the new Luciferian candidate for president. I mean, I don't like it, but, like, it's better than nothing. Until we can think of something better, I guess. Veruca Kosher Salt, $25. Appreciate that. Hi, Devin. Brilliant stream once again. Thank you. I have an unrelated question. So I was wondering what you yelled at Bill Kristol that one time. Was it Israel did 9/11 or Israel needs to fight their own dirty wars? You son of a Trotskyite whore or hey, neocon bagel sniffer. No, it was about Seth Rich. He was pretending that like WikiLeaks was like a Russian spy operation. It was, you know, who is he was talking to? Oh fuck, it was some Clinton administration guy. I forget the guy, but yeah, it was when the neocons were in full on WikiLeaks is Russian intelligence. Harmless G. Hey, Devin, I declare you an honorary member of the Electrical Engineer Master Race. Also, do you make up for your dysgenic, spiteful mutant ears with the Mormon glow, the distinctive high skin qualities of Mormons? My mutant ears? I don't have mutant ears. I'm pretty sure I got normal ears. With the Mormon glow, not sure what the Mormon glow is, the distinctively high skin quality of Mormons. I don't know. I've never heard of the Mormon glow or the mutant ears. I got normal ears. I got good ears, in fact. I don't think I got mutant ears. Unless you're talking about how I get detached earlobes. Is that like a weird thing? I always thought attached earlobes were weird. Detached is the way, where it's at. Guitar Dude, 1356. If and when the Jews succeed and the U.S. turns into Brazil, unless drastic change occurs, do you think they'll try to take China down next? I think they've been trying to infiltrate China for decades now with success because they don't look Chinese, unlike here, or without success. Israel's got a lot of financial ties with China, but I don't know. I don't know enough about, you know, it's one of those things where I'd love to be a fly on the wall during one of those meetings. But I don't think you're right in that. Look, the Chinese are well aware of Jewish power in the West. They teach about it in school. It's in their textbooks. And Jews don't look Chinese, but they still have influence in China. I mean, they're not dumb. Obviously, they've known this is going to be a rival. Because at the end of the day, what is this, right? What is it? They are trying to be the alpha. They are trying to remove competing groups. So obviously they're going to see that China is going to be a competing group, a very competent, hard to counter competing group. And look, it's not like the West fell overnight. You know, the influence of like the Rothschilds as an example started in what, like the 1600s. I mean, it's not like it just right away they were telling everyone what to do and steering the policy of every government. I mean, little by little they've taken control of the West. But they play the long game. And I suspect there's a similar strategy that's addressing China. In fact, look, if the last couple days have said anything, I think they're willing to, why not use the United States Golem to deal with China? Right, finance both sides and see, you know, and then side with whoever. You know, just like the Rothschilds, they finance the both sides of European wars. You know, finance. Why not finance Napoleon and England? And whoever wins, that's who we're loyal to. Nationalist Homestead, $5. Appreciate that. I keep stickers with links to Defiant to hand out to white people whenever I'm out in public. When I'm trying to red pill people, I like to recommend Hellstorm as second documentary. What sequence of videos would you recommend? Also, wanted to recommend The Plot Against the Church by Maurice Pinaim. Hellstorm. I feel like that's what... I don't think I've seen Hellstorm. And I definitely haven't seen The Plot Against the Church. I don't really have like a... Yeah, I don't know. I think, honestly, it depends on the person. But what I'm trying to convince people, and this might sound weird coming from someone who makes videos, I don't usually show them videos. Defiant is an exception. That's one I made that video specifically to try to just beat people over the head with it that refuse to see it. You know, that refuse to accept that whites are in a tight spot at the very least, right? the people that think everything's fine, like I specifically designed that video to beat them over the head with the idea that no, it's not. Look. But usually when I'm trying to convince people or to see things my way, it's just I try to do it verbally. And I guess that's just because obviously that's why I do streams. That's I got the gift of gab. I don't know. But yeah, so I never really think about the videos. I don't even really have like a list of see, that's the thing, too, is usually the videos that I like, the videos that I get the most out of are videos I know most people wouldn't sit through, you know? Like, they're, like, four-hour-long videos. That like, the Kay Griggs. I remember telling people forever to watch the Kay Griggs stuff. It's like 9 hours or something. Like, it's like 9 hours. It's like, or maybe it's 7 hours, but it's, like, really long. And I eventually had to do a stream on it because I knew no one was ever going to fucking watch it because it was just, like, way too long. But that's the kind of stuff that I get a lot out of. But I know that most people aren't going to do that, you know. But yeah, you know, I haven't seen these other two, but it's in good. They're in good company if you got the fight there. That's pretty cool. You're doing the sticker thing. Guitar Dude 1356. Why not team up with China Asian countries? Also high IQ folks, traditional values, and they like Western culture people. Probably a reason why Asian Americans get fucked in the West. Also, they never cover black on Asian attacks. Affirmative action also screws us. The problem with that is Asians almost never vote right wing. Almost never. Asians are like natural communists. I'll tell you what, if Republicans want to go around saying like, oh yeah, Latinos, they're like natural conservatives, well then Asians are natural fucking commies. Like that, they are for sure, 100%. And they're collectivist in nature, and they're collectivists not in like the way that makes them want to collect with you. You know, like they're very, they're very foreign. I mean, I don't think you can get more culturally foreign, or even genetically, really, in many ways, than blacks and Asians. Like, that's like the extremes in different directions from, like, if you look at whites as like the midpoint there. I don't know. I'm all about having what the left would call allies from all groups, really. I'm not opposed to like the existence of based black guys or based Asian guys, or, you know what I mean? That's not my focus, and I'm not like extra impressed with it. Like, you know, like conservatives like are super excited to, you know, oh my God, it's a based black guy. No, I'm just not impressed with it. I'm not impressed with it, but I'm not going to look a gift horse in the mouth. I don't think we need to band, you know, and plus, like, how would you even do that? You know, like, oh, let's team up with China. What does that mean? Start getting money from China? Like, the government's going to just start funding, you know what I mean? Like, and they, look, Trump signed speed of anti-terrorism laws. That's the quickest way to go to federal prison now, because they passed that law. I don't know if it was right before Trump or right after Trump got elected, but they made the excuse, the Russian interference was the excuse, right? Where if they think, I forget the exact wording, but the bottom line is, if they can tie, like my show, for example, right? If they were to tie what I do here to what they would call Russian or Chinese, or it doesn't matter. Like, it could be South African money, right? They could start saying that I'm a foreign agent. So, like, I forget how they word it, but basically they created a new kind of criminal. You know, that's they created a new kind of thought criminal. And that is someone that has ideas that the state doesn't like, that somehow receives funding from a an a foreign source. So if you start teaming up with China in any kind of official capacity, they can, at least would they do it? I don't know, but they'd have the at least the legal ability to come after you. Rob H, $5, appreciate that. Mr. Stack, this series is fantastic. Can we get a hard R for the culture? Hard R for the culture? I don't know what you mean by the hard R for the culture. You're gonna have to be more specific than that. I mean, I know what hard R is referencing to, but I don't know what the for the culture part. I don't know what you're getting at here. Thoughts on Harmless G. Thoughts on the film The Passion of the Christ. I know a lot of Jews seed that it. I also like that instead of making Satan look like a red cartoon, they depicted him as a creepy lesbian FTM tranny. I liked it. I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen it. I thought it was okay. Yeah, I thought the devil was pretty creepy in it. It had the little creepy mini devil that was inside the robes of the devil. What's the other one that he did? Apocalypto, I thought was pretty good too. Harmless G, I disagree with teaming up with Asians because although they are high IQ, high income, and low crime, they vote Democrat at even higher rates than Hispanics. They buy all the anti-white propaganda and education systems and fully support anti- Yeah, exactly. They do. They do. They really do. Harmless G, there is an UNS Review article called Beware of Overclass Immigrants Who Want to Dispossess White America, which lays out the problems of high-skilled legal immigrants, mostly from Asia, who become a part of America's elite and push the anti-white agenda at that level like the Jews do. Exactly. No, it's just like another class of – it's just another competing group, only that's more competent than the competing groups we've historically had to deal with. Yeah, you got high-performing groups like Indians, Asians – they come into our countries, and instead of taking like the job where you're carrying around a leaf blower, they're CEOs of things like Twitter, which is kind of a big deal. Postmaster, this stream has Chechnya vibes. Well, I'm not sure what you mean by that. Chechnya vibes. Some false flag stuff in Chechnya? Probably. Hammer of Thorzine, $10. Appreciate that. The narrator of the propaganda wasn't a CIA agent, but he sure did play one on TV, literally, for a decade. They chose him for this role on purpose, among others. The show was Homeland. Yep. Well, and that show is to get people to like the fact that there's Homeland Security. Like, oh, yeah, you should love that we have this entire agency meant to destroy white Christian men. I mean, that's what Homeland Security was for. Homeland Security was not for, ooh, the scary Muslims. It wasn't. And in fact, especially, we didn't really spend any time on that. But notice how the same explosive expert that was saying that the federal building in Oklahoma City was by that truck bottom bomb was the same explosive expert that did the data for the first World Trade Center bombing that everyone always forgets happened, that the FBI almost in almost 100% engineered. Night Nation Review. You have to let me get you on a channel on Shing.TV as a backup for when Odyssey is being shitty for you. It works great for me and is owned by the right people who won't censor you. It works great for me. If you fill out the channel application, I can get Rob to issue you a channel. Well, I'll check into it. Yeah, I don't know. I've never looked at that. I just can't, multi-stream, you know what I mean? Like, I can't. I mean, if it's another place to upload to, maybe. But is it really going to get the kind of traffic that... Is it going to get like 10 views is what I'm getting at? Is it worth it? Because for me to upload things like that are 4 hours long, it takes 2 hours at least, right? And sometimes I got to just sit here and watch it because it'll, you know, because the crappy internet will drop out and I got to restart it. And I'm, you know, I don't want to add like yet one more place I got to upload to unless it's going to be seen by people, you know? And as far as streaming live, I can't multi-stream right now for obvious reasons. I can't even like solo stream sometimes. Harmless G, a great movie to do would be American Made, where Tom Cruise plays Barry Seal, a pilot who ends up working for both the CIA and Pablo Escobar's Medellin cartel as a spy and drug smuggler. I don't think I've seen that. I wonder how recent that is. Might have to look into that. On the topic of Pablo Escobar, the Netflix series Narcos, which depicts the story of the Medellin cartel in its first two seasons, has a CIA character who is involved with everyone and plays every side. I think I saw some episodes of that, and it seemed pretty okay. But that was a long time ago. Disclaimer, I don't pay to watch any of these movies or shows. You can watch any movie or TV show online for free if you know where to look. Yes, you can. 3AM Creeper, $5. Appreciate that. I've heard rumors from my fellow Antichrist haters that this could be Tim, Steve M. D'Antuono. I don't know what that is. Head FBI field office agent of Detroit. I don't know. What are you sending me here? What am I looking at? Steve Antuaha? Oh, are you talking about John Doe number 2 being this guy? I mean, I don't know. I could be, but like, I don't know. I don't know anything about this guy. No way to know. Bloodstained Oy Vey, $1. Any other good documentaries, videos that are Hollywoodism tier that would be good to upload on YouTube? Normie-friendly content like it makes Jews nervous and scatterbrained in trying to manufacture consensus in the comments. New subscribers showed me there is a hunger for that kind of content. About Hollywood? I mean, not really. Hollywoodism was... a rare moment of honesty that happened in the 90s. I guess maybe if you look at the 90s. 90s was this weird time where the philo-Semitism in America was so high that openly bragging about Jewish accomplishments that would normally be minimized or even hidden in the past... You know, it was a celebration of Jewishness that didn't elicit panic from Jews, because everywhere they looked, people were like sucking up the Jews. It was, you know, the biggest show on TV was Seinfeld, and everyone was. I mean, it was. There wasn't even like all a comic had to do to get a laugh out of a crowd would just make some joke about having a Jewish mom, or like, well, that's because I'm a Jew, or just say Jew funny, and everyone laughs because everyone just fucking loved Jews during the 90s. I don't know why. Well, I mean, like, the propaganda was just, I think that was just like the peak. So if you're looking for some place where you're getting a documentary that's bragging about stuff or is less guarded about Jewish involvement in a particular topic, I would look at the 90s. B-pill, or Mycroft Tomes, $10. B-pill, I come here for the white pills. Reality's too depressing. Well, I'll tell you what. I'm shooting a major B-pill tomorrow. I can't tell you what it is, but it's, like, major. And it may lead to B disaster. Or B awesomeness. I'm not sure yet. I'm going to find out tomorrow. And I'll wear a body cam as I do it. And then I'll turn it into a B-pill by Saturday. Or hopefully by Saturday. I can't, no promises. Colonel N-word, $1. Hey, Devin, how long do you think it'll take for the system to implode? I'm still stuck in the city. I don't know. I don't know. I got out just because, like, every year it's weirder than the year before. We're in totally uncharted territory. So, I feel like you're kind of playing with fire, but who knows, right? You might have 100 years. But I'm not going to roll the dice on that one. Damn Bigfoot, $3. Appreciate that. I don't know if you ever covered this, but do you believe the group The Order that did the armored truck robberies was an attempt to take down Pierce? Yeah, it could be. I haven't done any kind of heavy-duty research into them. But they do get mentioned a lot in a lot of this stuff. But it's always like a throwaway line, like, oh, and he was tied to this group, The Order. And then they don't really go into detail. But at least the official story is a lot of those guys are in prison right now. So, I mean, I guess it'd be somewhat easy to tell, right, if they're still in prison. A channel, $2. Appreciate that. Devin, I can't help but reveal my power level to my friends and family. I'm alienating many, but some recognize that I make valid points, but it is tough being rejected and alienated. Well, just like I said, be nice about it then. Maybe you're not being nice about it. Now, there's a difference between not being able to hide your power level and being like an asshole about it. You know? That's the thing. You don't have to hide who you are and to not be an asshole. You know, you can be a nice guy and also have unpopular opinions. That's totally legit. Also, you don't have to be, and you also don't have to talk about it constantly, right? Like it's one thing to hide your true thoughts and opinions about stuff, but it's another thing to just not have to bring it up all the time. There's other things in the world. You know, like bees, for example, would be, you know, for me. So it's just not something you have to always bring up at the dinner table. So maybe that's all it is, right? And look, I get the temptation, especially when you understand the urgency and how deep these problems go, and you want to spread the information, and that's important, and you should. But maybe it's also important to take a breather every now and again, so you don't exhaust the people around you who might not have the same interest level or maybe even aptitude that you've got. Before Forever, $10. Appreciate that. Hey, Devin, another great stream. It is chilling to know that these devils will stop at nothing to uphold their BS narrative and policies. I was chatting to an acquaintance recently, and he said that he likes the Clintons. Both of them. Hey, look, so does Trump. He said they're nice people. Very nice people. He is beyond hope. Anyway, looking forward to the next part. God bless you. Well, like I said, Trump loves the Clintons too. So, you know, I wouldn't be too harsh on your friend. Mein Kampf chair. $10. Appreciate that. Shout out to my neighbor, Johnny. If you're watching, I introduced him to this stream after he overheard me watching it out of my balcony. It was the Independence Day stream. And the first thing he hears is Devin shouting, "Look how Jewy this faggot is." Well, there you go. Was I talking about Merrick Garland? Because it could apply to this guy, too. 6% or Teha. 6% of all Asians derive directly from Genghis Khan. He had a ministry for the supply of fertile women. Yeah, that there's a shocking amount of Asians that are all related to one guy, which is why they all look very similar. Tennis Nuts, $3. Great stream. Just wanted to mention John MacArthur of... Whoops. It actually... Oh, good. It leads to an update to the very top like it used to do. Of Grace to You, a church who has stood their ground with traditional values. They don't speak on every problem, but they do address LGBT and the takeover of the church almost every week. Well, that's cool. John MacArthur of Grace to You. I'm not familiar with them, but maybe I'll check them out sometime. Green Apu 45, $2. Appreciate that. First time donator. Been watching your content since the YouTube days. How do you feel about HR 1808? I think the boomers and most other people will do nothing if it passes in the Senate and would probably turn in their guns as well. Also, ever look into the miracle of Fatima? It ties into many things. HR 1808, is that the new gun control law? Let me look. Yeah, okay. Yeah, this is the banning of AR. All right, let's see here. Yeah. Makes it a crime to knowingly import, sell, manufacture, transfer, possess semi-automatic weapons or large capacity ammunition, feeding devices. Yeah. It basically is, it would set you back to having like bolt action fucking rifles and shotguns. Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't think this will go anywhere. I think this would be the Second Amendment faggots who never actually do anything. I think this might actually activate their almonds a little too much. And as for the Fatima thing, I don't know. I've watched a few videos on it. It seems kind of like Catholic lore that I don't quite understand. But who knows? I just don't believe in like Mary being a thing. I mean, obviously I think she was a person, but I don't think God sends women to do men's work, to put it plainly. Colonel N-Word, $1. Whenever you bring up bees, it makes me think of Nicolas Cage at the end of The Wicker Man. Yeah, I've never seen the Nicolas Cage version of that. And the 80s version I saw like a billion years ago. So I'd have to look at it. Damn Bigfoot, $3. My ex made me watch Homeland. One of the newer seasons had a Waco Ruby Ridge plot line with that Jewish narrator guy being a negotiator painting feds as good. Of course. Of course it did. Yeah, I mean, honestly, he's probably, because look, a lot of people who are on television are also CIA or also tied to intelligence agencies. Just because he just plays a CIA agent or you know, Homeland Security agent or whatever it is, right, on TV, doesn't mean he doesn't have direct ties to these people in real life. In fact, I almost feel like he'd have to. If you look at the roster of the people that are involved in this awful fucking show, there's almost no way he doesn't have connections to these people. Or it could just be, you know, they could just cast the guy because of, you know, enough people trust him. He's got that trustable voice. All right. Last but not least, just came in. Champ, $1. Never relax around blacks, never snooze around Jews. There you go. All right, guys. Well, I'm going to put a close to this. I'm pretty tired. Part 4 will be on Saturday. and we will have a B pill possibly. Check out the new shirts. I took away one of the old ones and have inserted the new one. So get them all the getting's good. And I'm going to get better about updating them more often. Like, I wanted to do it every other stream, and I kind of dropped the ball for a few streams there. So, anyway. And then, yeah, Fascist Freddy just mentioned that Tucker Carlson applied to the CIA, and Anderson Cooper did some work for the CIA student. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, so many people on TV are tied directly to these agencies. Tucker Carlson is no exception. All right, guys. Hope you guys have a wonderful evening. I'll see you on Saturday for Black Pill Dime, of course.
Devastag.
In 16 years, it'll be the year 2000. He'll be 19 years old. What happens if every tax dollar that we pay, 50-60% of it, just going to pay the interest on the debt? He will be paying for what we lived on. We should be investing to allow him to be able to live on something.
Joe Biden wants an immediate budget freeze, a constitutional amendment to limit spending, and a fair tax bill to guarantee our children's future. Delaware's own Joe Biden.
Sailing out across Oklahoma on the man-made river and canal. Hey, hey, cowboy, you better watch out, or the riverboat sailor man will steal your gal. I never conceived or ever believed that in my life I'd see a big boat sailing up the Cimarron River out on the Lone Prairie. But it gives my heart a thrill to see the big boat a-steaming through the jungle across the Oklahoma hills. Big boat sailing out across Oklahoma on the man-made river and canal. Hey, hey, cowboy, you better watch out, or the riverboat sailor man will steal your gal. The big boats breeze through the Florida Keys and the Gulf of Mexico, then head north from New Orleans through the Louisiana Bayou. Turn left at the Arkansas, on the interstate waterway across Oklahoma up to Wichita. Big boat sailing out across Oklahoma on the man-made river and canal. Hey, hey, cowboy, you better watch out, or the riverboat sailor man will steal your gal. Hey, hey, cowboy, you better watch out, or the riverboat sailor man will steal your gal. Or the riverboat sailor man will steal your gal. Or the riverboat sailor man will steal your gal. Or the riverboat